You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
So if we can just get Cuba back, they're not going to get rid of Kennedy. They're going to be fighting over Cuba. They're going to be dividing Cuba among themselves. So this is how I was persuaded that it was a good idea to kill Castro.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Judith Ferry Baker. Today's show, the cancer bioweapon and plot to kill JFK. Judith Ferry Baker is an author, teacher, and an artist. She is the author of two nonfiction personal memoirs, Me and Lee, How I Came to Know, Love, and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald, and David Ferry, Mafia Pilot, Participant in Anti-Castro Bioweapon Plot, Friend of Lee Harvey Oswald, and Key to the JFK Assassination. She was once a promising young science prodigy who hoped one day to find a cure for cancer. She offers extensive documentation on how she came to be a cancer expert at such a young age, the personalities who urged her to relocate to New Orleans, and what led to her involvement in the development of a biological weapon that Oswald was to smuggle into Cuba to eliminate Fidel Castro. Early on in the summer of 1963, during her work in New Orleans, she learned of plans to kill the president. Judith Ferry Baker, welcome.
Hello, Bonnie. Nice to hear you.
It's such a pleasure to finally meet you. I only wish it was in person. Judith, I think we should start with a brief history of how you were brought to New Orleans in April of 1963 to develop a fast-acting cancer bioweapon to be used to assassinate Fidel Castro. I did a two-part program with Ed Haslam, author of Dr. Mary's Monkey, in which he talked quite a bit about you on the show, but there are bound to be many listeners who did not catch those programs. You were a young high school science prodigy, weren't you?
Well, and yes, but a lot of people think like I went straight to New Orleans from high school. Actually, I had 2 years of training in advanced methods, you know, working in oncological methods. You're talking about tissue culture. I actually developed a test to determine whether someone had cancer just using a blood test. And by the way, it took 46 years before they created a similar blood test. So when I was removed or kicked out of cancer research because of objecting to using prisoners, you know, who were unaware that when they volunteered to, you know, work and, you know, be volunteers in cancer research, that if the materials we injected into them proved effective, they would die, you know. So I really regret the fact that I've been was banned from cancer research by the same organization that gave me so much hope and promised me, you know, early entry into Tulane University Medical School, you know, would skip 2 years of college. That would be working with the eminent doctors, and especially Dr. Mary Sherman, have free room and board and a stipend and all that. And it looked like everything was just so wonderful to be able to come to New Orleans. And, of course, I'd been trained at Roswell Park Institute to handle the deadly viruses that could cause cancer, such as SV40 monkey virus, with Dr. James T. Grace. In a summer program there with, under Dr. Moran, just for seminars. And I was working in particular in that entire summer for Dr. George E. Moore. He was the director of that institute, which was a very highly recognized cancer research institute. It's now called Roswell Park Institute. That, right then it was called Roswell Park Memorial Institute for Cancer Research. And what's important about that is that I learned how to also formulate one of the best formulas. And I say formulate because we were still working on it. The formula that we were working on that would allow us to grow cancer cells faster than ever before and more efficiently keep them alive longer. Today it's called RPMI, that is Roswell Park Memorial Institute, RPMI 1640. And this formula came out a few years after I was there, but we were working in Dr. Moore's own private lab creating this. So I spent some time actually helping to create this formula in 1961, And at the time that I reached New Orleans, I was probably one of the few people in the world that had access to that formula outside of the Institute. So I had some special skills that were valuable, plus the fact I could read 2,400 words a minute, and they needed to get a lot of the latest research updated to see where they could go next. They had reached an impasse in this project, which had begun on March 23, 1962. Dr. Ochsner, of course, had been lured into, oh, hey, we have something here that could be called a biological weapon. It was an anomaly, and they took advantage of it. Dr. Ochsner was virulently anti-Castro and anti-communist. He resented the fact that Castro had cut off Cuba from all the training of young doctors that he had conducted. They would come there and stay at Brent House, as they did from all over South America and Latin America in general. All of a sudden, he had no more access to them. And I would tell you, their parents weren't happy about that either. Some of them were doctors. I mean, their young men were being shipped off now to USSR for training. We come back, and they put them on salaries and sent them out to take care of the peasants and so on. There's one example of a doctor, a young doctor, who was very resentful and trusted, who had wanted to become a famous and rich plastic surgeon. And my joke is that now instead he's working on taking, ingrown toenails out of people, you know. So there was some resentment there. Dr. Ochsner had trusted the medical community himself. He understood what trust was because, of course, he had inoculated his own grandson. It's widely said that his grandson died within just a few days. Actually, his grandson came down with he was inoculated with the polio vaccine by Dr. Ochsner, his own grandson. He became ill in a couple of days. He died a week later. And this devastated Dr. Ochsner, who had trusted the Qatar vaccine in which he had stock. And he realized if he could trust doctors that much with something that could be injected into your body, so would Castro. And believe it or not, some of the doctors that Castro trusted shouldn't have been trusted. And there were also technicians. If you have a little bottle and look, it's labeled penicillin, but it really contains virulent active cancer cells that could kill you, how would you know? So what if a technician turns up the x-ray machine really high when Castro was standing in front of it on his checkup, which was coming up? How would you know it, and it wouldn't have been turned up? So he got a huge dose. And then what if certain cancer cells were placed in a blood sample and they're looking at the microscope and they see live cancer cells in this blood sample? They're going to put him in front of an x-ray again machine to see if there are any tumors. And when he gets a full body scan like that, he's going to be, he's going to be inundated with a lot more x-rays. You can imagine what the plan was. And there were people in line to do it. Why such an elaborate scheme? Because everything they tried, I mean, look, Castro's still alive. The CIA had tried everything. So this was a long-term project, and somewhere during the project it was learned, it was a little too late, but we learned that the decision had been made to kill Kennedy, and it seemed to Dr. Sherman and David Ferry and others. David Ferry, by the way, pretended to be anti-Kennedy. He changed his mind after he, that's a long story, I'll talk about it some other time, but basically David Ferry was someone who knew Lee Oswald for a long time. My book, David Ferry, Mafia Pilot, explains who he is, and of course he's in the film JFK. You can see his representation by Joe Pesci. However you pronounce his name. Anyway, David Ferry actually was very anti-Castro, anti-communist, and he was for some period of time anti-Kennedy because he blamed Kennedy for what happened at the Bay of Pigs. He had trained so many of these young people, and some of them actually died. One of them suffocated to death, Dave told me, in a container. It was left out in the sun of like over 100 people in it, or 90 people, something like that, and they were prisoners, and they were being hauled, you know, into a camp somewhere. And a number of them suffocated to death and died of heat stroke and so on when they opened up the container. I mean, they baked them in there, and David didn't forget that, and he was certain that Kennedy, he really stood up there in front of 70 officers, retired military officers. He was a gifted speaker and rhetorician, and he said Kennedy should be shot. Well, they made him get off the stage, but he said, look, Dave, come here. We want to talk to you. We feel the same way about Kennedy. Would you like to learn a little more? Do you really feel like that? And, of course, he did at the time. Later, David Ferry learned that it wasn't Kennedy who was to blame for all of that. It was his treacherous generals, treacherous CIA. And now when he understood, he was deep into where talks were going on, and some of them, a few of them, were serious. And that's the background here. When I came to New Orleans, David Ferry secretly now realizes that President Kennedy is in deep trouble. He has learned about some groups that want to kill him. He believes and tells Dr. Mary Sherman, if we can't kill Castro and divert these ideas from developing into something more dangerous, it was already known that Kennedy would be coming to Texas. You had Albert Thomas was supposedly quite ill. He's in Houston, and he had been a congressman or had just retired, or maybe still was, but he'd soon leave the position. And Albert Thomas, they were going to hold a dinner for him, a kind of a, you know, thank you. Thank you, Albert, for being our wonderful congressman. And he's going to retire or something like that. Kennedy, that's how he was invited to Texas. And it turned into something else. But we have a famous photo showing Lyndon Johnson soon after he's sworn in, right there on Air Force One, turning his head. Lady Bird is smiling in her kind of a grim smile. Jackie Kennedy is looking like she has just been dragged through the plumes of the fires of hell, standing there at his side. And he's looking over at Albert Thomas, who's giving a wink. He's winking at Lyndon Johnson. Now, that was what we were trying to avoid. I was led to believe I got on the secret side of things accidentally. Originally, I was supposed to work with Dr. Sherman in her regular bone lab, and they would be giving me materials, and I would be working on them there. But as it turned out, David Ferry had been selected to break the ring. There was a ring of labs that was involved, at least three or four labs. And the problem was is they could communicate with each other if the ring was completed. David was chosen because Mary Sherman had been training him. David had been in cancer research as an amateur, but he was a brilliant man. Great pilot, knew five languages fluently. He spoke French, German, Italian, Spanish, and English. And besides that, he knew ancient Greek, modern Greek, and Latin, and so on. This man, again, a gifted speaker and able to speak in many languages, and was actually a pilot at that time going between New Orleans and cities such as Dallas and Houston on a regular route with Eastern Airlines. Now, by the time I met him, he had been fired by Eastern Airlines for an incident with a 15-year-old boy. Now, all of this comes together because David is now, he was basically rescued by Carlos Marcello, the godfather of New Orleans, got him a job with G. Ray Gill, and also he was working for Guy Bannister. We see that he was actually analyzing autopsies for Bannister. And in the book, David Ferry, again, you're going to find out a lot more about that and how he learned to analyze autopsies. But all of this comes together that David has some medical information and understanding, and he understands especially how to handle cancer. And that's not for everybody. Not everybody can do that. And he was chosen by Dr. Sherman, and she gave him some training so that he would be able to handle this virus, this very powerful cancer that had been developed using a linear particle accelerator to create mutations. And some of the mutations, most of them, of course, are no good. But when you're talking about using 500 mice at a time, 50 mice at a time, and eventually it was 500 mice at a time, then we went to monkeys, you see, finally to test humans.
I'm speaking with author and former cancer researcher Judith Ferry Baker. Today's show, The Cancer Bioweapon and Plot to Kill JFK. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
All of this, I'm told that we can avoid World War III, and maybe 20 million Americans won't die if we can make sure that Castro is out of the picture, will never again aim nuclear weapons at me and my family and everybody in you in Florida and at the United States of America and all the people there. This is what I was told. And when I came to New Orleans, I thought, again, I was going to be on the open side of everything. I didn't know what the nature of the project was, but through a series of circumstances, which involved Lee and his meeting me, because when I came to New Orleans, I came 2 weeks early, and there was nobody there. Nobody. Like, I'm talking about my doctors were in South America, and we have a newspaper article about it. I don't know where exactly Mary Sherman was, but she was out of town as well. And here I was at loose ends. I'd expected steak and you know, and wine. I didn't drink wine, but you get the picture, I think. I thought I was going to be met by famous doctors. They were going to love me and take good care of me. They promised to do so, and I was going to work my tail off for them. I wanted to cure cancer. That was my goal. My grandma had died of it, and all the newspaper articles, I had newspaper reporters following me around because of all the, I had given mice lung cancer in only 7 days in my own primitive circumstances in Manatee High School, working in a lab that was moved under the stadium, because when those tumors started developing, we had some frightened, high school science teachers and others, you know, so. We had 2 Nobel Prize winners. We had 3 doctors, the best there were, Dr. George Morgan, director at Roswell Park. We had Dr. Harold Diehl, D-I-E-H-L, the vice president of the American Cancer Society, and who, in fact, was the head of all the research projects for the American Cancer Society. And then with him, Dr. Alton Ochsner, who was flown in after I displayed and showed the work that I had done, and they wanted him to help inspect this. Of course, it was in the newspapers, you know, Judith meets with 2 Nobel Prize winners and all of this. And it says because I had done something that had never been done before, I was now going to be sent to Roswell Park and so on. Well, that went on briefly, about 2 years of training I received. And at the same time, of course, I'm going to college. I was estranged from my parents. My fiancé was supposed to be coming. When I was eventually banned from cancer research for testing about these prisoners being used, I was sent back to Florida to save my life. But also there, because I had married this man, I was Mrs. Robert Allison Baker III. It really, really helped to hide who I was. As everybody that worked on the project, almost all of them were murdered. So it's just, I say everybody I know who was working on the project. So that's where it was. And here's Lee Oswald. He's being sent to kind of make sure I don't get hurt. I'm an asset that they want to use. Because he wasn't told enough, and I knew so much about, well, like anti-Castorites. I had been working, after all, in Florida. I had dated, for example, the son of the finance minister of Castro's Cuba. It was Tony Lopez Frisquet. And, oh, he was a cute guy. He really was. But he told me nightmare things about Castro. So I really hated Castro, and here I was hating Kennedy. One of the things that Lee did over time was he taught me to admire and respect and even love President Kennedy. This is what I had in high school before I'd been influenced by all my anti-Castro Cuban friends at University of Florida. What a change, what a difference it was to know somebody like Lee, who had such respect and admiration for our president. So I'll take a breath here. You might have wondered if I've taken you too far in too many directions here. Let's see what you think.
Well, no, that's very interesting, Judith. Now, whose brainchild was the fast-acting cancer bioweapon? You sort of indicated that it was Dr. Yeah. Ochsner's project.
Well, it seems that Dr. Ochsner had worked quite a while with Dr. Mary Sherman. She had gotten interested in polio herself. She was an orthopedic surgeon. She had to go over to Crippled Children's Hospital all the time and do surgery on their legs to unbend them because the tendons would get all tight and they'd be all curled up, and she'd have to move the tendons on the bones. Sometimes they had to cut up one bone here or there so that it was got twisted or whatever, and she saw all the suffering going on. She was very concerned. She and Dr. Ochsner were very concerned about the fact that this vaccine that was supposed to cure polio and all that actually was giving people polio and killing them. When they inspected it and looked into it, they found the SV40 monkey virus, a completely different thing than what they were looking for. And basically, when they inspected the virus and wondered what it did, and at first wondered if that was what was causing the problems, they began culturing it. And lo and behold, when they did tissue cultures with it, cancer began to grow very rapidly. And she had Sarah Stewart and Sarah Eddie. We have these oncologists and research scientists that Dr. Sherman knew in Chicago, and she was in contact with them. Basically, it looks like Dr. Sherman was able to realize that we had something that causes cancers in 100% of any primates that were injected with it. What would it do in humans? That was a concern. And when she found out, as they all did, in 1963, we had 98 million doses of this material loaded with the SV40 cancer-causing monkey virus. And the government was hiding it. They had already had too many recalls already of, you know, contaminated polio vaccines. And the word came out, well, look, we're going to cure cancer before this erupts in the human population. Let's not worry about it. Let's eradicate polio. And besides, we'll lose an awful lot of money. And besides, people will be afraid of vaccines if we recall 98 million doses of it. So they gave it to us. So, yeah, so Mary Sherman sees this. They were trying to work with this, the SV40 monkey virus. They found that it could create a rapidly developing cancer. By the time I got in the project, they had a monstrous cancer. It was nothing like I'd ever seen before, and I'd seen a lot. And this was outrageous. The cancer cells would divide and multiply so quickly, and it seemed that they overgrew themselves immediately. They just went so quickly from stage to stage, and Mary had actually stopped them at different stages and labeled the times, and I could see how fast this could grow. It was frightening, and I was intrigued. She wanted me to see it. They talked to me about how I'd accidentally been brought into the wrong site because David Ferry had looked for an assistant, had asked for an assistant because his Eastern Airline hearings, trying to get his job back with Eastern Airlines, they had him go to Miami a lot. And the other thing that was going on, which was just as important as Carlos Marcello, trusted him. He's just a genius, wanted him to help him with his upcoming trial. And here David was all locked up in trying to get this cancer thing done in his kitchen. And he had the ability, to do it there. It's not as complicated as you might think in certain areas. You know, you need lots of acetone and lots of Bunsen burner. You know, you've got to have fire, and you have to have means to clean up and keep it clean. And David Ferry's kitchen needed cleaning all the time. At any rate, here we have David Ferry has been given this training. He's asked for an assistant. He thought I was the one because since he was a homosexual, that they wouldn't send a guy. And here I'm a girl coming in, so he accepted that. They told me a lot more than they should because the doctors were not in town. Mary Sherman then has to tell me the truth. She and Dr. Ochsner had decided, they're very anti-Castro and they're very pro-anti-communist, that they thought it behooved them to take this material, Castro smoked cigars like a smokestack, and all this time these three doctors, Dr. Deal, Dr. Moore, and Dr. Ochsner had gone all around and trying to discourage people from smoking. They had already, even before the Surgeon General's stuff came out, I think in 65, we have these three doctors testifying in court that smoking cigarettes or cigars will give you cancer. Dr. Oxnard put out a book about it, and now the stage was ready. Castro needed to be eliminated for everybody's good. You see that Oxnard puts in the newspaper, he says, doctors need to join the Cold War and fight in the Cold War with every means they have. And he is doing so himself. So here we've got, he's got the idea. Let's keep it spread around that smoking causes cancer. Let it keep going. And here's Judy Vary, who has created lung cancer in mice faster than it had ever been done in any of the laboratories at that time. And I've got this training, and they bring me to New Orleans. And I also, I bring with me the formula that can grow these cancers even faster. So there you are. That's what happened to me. Then Lee Oswald, because I was at loose ends, and I had very little money when I came here, and the Oxnard was out of town. The clinic didn't know a thing about this because the papers hadn't been signed yet. And so I was thrust into a room. Well, it's the only room I could afford at the YWCA. I thought I was going to be moving into a nice private room like had been done with me before at the Y. Instead, I'm in with four girls, you know, two strippers, a Playboy bunny, and a waitress who was so tough, I had to give her 25 cents a day so she wouldn't steal my clothes.
Oh my God.
Yeah. That was the situation, and in just a week, I was there from about the 19th, arrived, 20th, 21st, 22nd, 23rd, 24th, 25th. I mean, something's got to be done. I've already now been in all the strippers, you know, I've been in the show, I'm in all these different clubs, nightclubs downtown. The girls say, look, you're 19 years old, you mean you've never seen a pasty? You know, and things like that. And how about being a Playboy bunny? Well, I ended up taking a job that was only 2 hours a day at Royal Castle, enough to pay for my room until the doctors got back. It didn't take any time at all. They introduced me to David Ferry, and Lee did that. He was sent, obviously, to protect me and rescue me. I was an asset. And because of different circumstances, you can read about in the book, they thought I knew a lot more about the project and that I was the person that they had requested to be on the secret side. And since I was a girl, it seemed I really fit the bill. And by the time the doctors got back, it was too late. They had to put me in on the secret side of it. The secret side was very important because, as I say, it broke that ring and it made it possible for the doctors not to be in communication with each other and figure out what was going on. So that, in a nutshell, and that's a big nut, isn't it?
I'm speaking with author and former cancer researcher Judith Vary Baker. Today's show, The Cancer Bioweapon and Plot to Kill JFK. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Anyway, that's the background and where it led to with the information that David Ferry had. He is telling Lee about it. Lee Oswald will get involved. What he was doing there was making sure that Castro knew there were efforts going to be made to try to kill him. Castro knew that in New Orleans, of all places, we had whole groups of anti-Castro insurgents who were being trained to come in there and invade Cuba, trained some of them by David Ferry to go and drop bombs. And some of them were incendiary bombs, but others were like they're dropping biological weapons. I'm talking about, you know, pigs were getting sick, they had dengue fever. I mean, they were using biological means against the people of Cuba, not just Castro, but they're trying to destroy the entire island's productivity and got rid of almost all the sugarcane crops after the Bay of Pigs. I mean, they just kept bombing and bombing and bombing before and after. They'd never take responsibility. These were always, you know, bush planes that came in, boom. And there's the fire. There the fire is raging. And Castro is getting not much help. Khrushchev, if he gives him too much help, the United States has very, very bad relationship with the communist giant. And Khrushchev, you know, beating his shoe on the podium there at UN, we will bury you. That doesn't come across too well, you know. So it was a scary time. It was a time when only 6 months after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when we thought we came so close to the brink of war. If it hadn't been for the courage of John F. Kennedy and his brother, I don't think we'd be here. So those were the times.
Now, one other question on cancer. In addition to the fast-acting cancer bioweapon project that you were a part of,
yeah,
were you ever aware of any real research going on there being done in New Orleans to either find a cure for cancer or to develop a cancer vaccine?
Well, not just in New Orleans, but because I said, remember I said I read 2,400 words a minute, and they used that as an asset to, for me to digest. And people said, how can you read that fast? And I've tried to explain. For example, some people who don't read very well, it's T-H-E is the, you know, they have to look at each letter. Others can read the, and some can read the horse ran down the street. Some can read a whole sentence. So I could read a page like that, and it was very useful. Now, it took a lot of strength and concentration to do that because of the technical aspect. But actually, technical papers are easier to read than something that raises your emotions. So it wasn't as difficult as you might think. But they needed to get into these. And, yes, paper after paper I'm reading because they're trying to get the most up-to-date information on any of the viruses on any, that are causing cancer, any of the cancers. Definitely, we were on our way to a cure for cancer. We should have had it in the 70s, especially, as I say, using bacteriophage and other methods. We had it. We know that Pope John the 23rd died of stomach cancer, and the envoys were sent there, not in time, but they had a cancer vaccine with them. Remember that word, vaccine, a cancer serum. They were going to give him, try to save his life, but they were too late. So what was so potent that they could have developed something that they might use in a last-minute attempt to save the Pope's life? Well, we're looking at some very advanced technology and working in oncology. We have no doubt in my mind that we could have cured cancer in the 1970s. But you know what? It doesn't make money. When you have whole institutions set up, gigantic cancer research, no, they aren't cancer research. They are cancer treatment centers. And they have their palm trees and their fountains. And as I look at that, I think of the despairing people who've plowed all their money into trying to save their loved ones that built these giant, these gorgeous edifices. And that money has been poured into buildings, poured into technologies that are based on three primitive factors. One, to cut it out. Well, if it's a nice, firm tumor, cut it out and it's gone. But then after they cut it out, they almost always do radiation because in their primitive minds, they think that you have to do radiation after cutting something out. Well, it depends on the tumor, believe me, but they usually go in, conduct radiation anyway, and often on top of that, chemo. And of course, that's cutting it, burning it, and poisoning it. But unfortunately, that it's almost always involves the entire human body, or at least such specific parts of it in such a dramatic way. It's entirely primitive, and all avenues that that go anywhere else that don't lead into these three primitive area ways of treating cancer are considered illegitimate and not worth following, frankly, because they don't make money. When you've already set up an enormous machine here where, you know, you have like mammograms, you have that you actually have the trucks going from city to city, you know, smashing women's breasts and giving them x-rays. And, of course, recently we had a doctor protest this and say at least a third of the so-called cancers turn out to be nothing but benign tumors, and yet they've had their breasts cut off before this was understood. When we should have been able to use thermograms, well, thermograms are cheap. Thermography is cheap. You find a hot spot on your breast, and then you look at it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the primitive idea that we have to do biopsies of everything we're looking at. We really have the technology to actually enter any tumor and look at it and figure out whether it's cancerous or not, but they still use this quite primitive, in my opinion, biopsy method, which when you pull out and you break into the tumor, you know what? You can shed tumor cells all over the body by doing that. You're opening it up. If it's encapsulated and you punch into it, you know, and you withdraw a needle or whatever, and you know what you're getting, or you pull a slice out of it. You've got an open wound there in the cancer, and you know, you can fill up around it with lymphatic matter, with serum, And, of course, it can then actually leak into the rest of the body, shed that cancer all over the place. What is going on? Well, it's the same method they've always used. They haven't advanced, only in the sophistication of the chemicals, of the poisons. And the idea that you can eat something or drink something or have it pumped into your veins, and it's going to kill a batch of cancer in your body. And what about the rest of your body? Well, those cells, they don't multiply as quickly. Now, I'll tell you what does multiply as quickly as cancer cells. That's the cells on the hair of your head. That's why all these poor people go bald. It's killing off the cells that actually multiply most rapidly. Well, guess what? A lot of cells in your body multiply rapidly, like on your fingernails. Mm-hmm. So what have we got there? We have an extremely primitive situation where this makes a lot of money. It's all been set up. It's a huge machine. You have to keep feeding the machine with lots of money. People are being trained to run the machine, and they're not going to get out of the machine. It's too profitable. That's why overseas, like, for example, in Sweden, five universities have gotten together. They're not run by any corporations. Five universities have come together, and they're looking at genetic ways to cure cancer. Doesn't make any money, folks, so you're not going to see it here.
Now, Judith, when you were developing the fast-acting cancer bioweapon, it wasn't, as I recall, it wasn't going fast enough, so you came up with a way to include X-rays with it that would speed up
right.
The cancer.
Yes, it's remarkable to me that doctors can be right on top of things. I'm not trying to criticize them, but if you've been working with something a long time, you've been trained a certain way. My advantage was that I hadn't been trained like that. I'd trained myself, and because of that, I had used approaches that they hadn't used. And when I was looking, I'd given mice lung cancer, not with ordinary mice. I eventually had gone to germ-free mice, which were available in Tampa through a research incorporated, and I had given funds to them, and they had connections with Notre Dame, so that's how I got access to them. My family at one time was involved with Notre Dame, and to make a long story short, we just loved Notre Dame, and we had given land, and my ancestors had given land to Notre Dame. So I had these connections with Notre Dame. This doctor actually moved to Tampa with his germ-free mice from Notre Dame, and I was in contact with him through my family and everything. He supplied me with germ-free mice. Now, that means they had no contact whatsoever. They had no antibodies in their system. And then on top of that, I x-rayed them, I used x-rays, and that destroyed their immune system. That's how come I could do it. Well, that was a really unusual approach to it. And for some reason, reducing or demolishing the immune system is something that they'd forgotten or not thought about when they're, said reach an impasse. And said, look, all we have to do is make sure that Castro gets himself put in front of an x-ray machine for whatever reasons you want to get. And if you give him a big dose of x-ray, you know what happens? You develop a dry cough. Or if you just make it look like he's got cancer by putting a few cancer cells in one of his blood tests that he has, they're going to be terrified. They're going to go back. If you get somebody to get him in front of an x-ray machine a couple of times, he's going to feel so sick. And they're going to be giving him injections. And maybe they'll give him injections, say it's penicillin, just like they did to Jack Ruby, by the way. Mm-hmm. Jack Ruby understood what we were doing. When that poor man, when Julian West came from Chicago, that's the MK Ultra man. He goes and tells the outside world that Jack Ruby is crazy. Why? Well, we have Al Maddox, the jailer there. I talked to him for hours and got a lot of information from him. He says, that man came in and he gave Jack Ruby some drugs. He said, gave Jack, and they were friends, gave Jack some drugs. And all of a sudden, Jack is beating his head against a wall, and he's sticking his hand up into trying to kill himself by putting his hand up, unscrewed a light bulb, trying to electrocute himself by putting his fingers up into the light socket. And then Julian West, he can inject him with cancer cells. And when Jack Ruby says, I've been injected with cancer cells, nobody's going to believe him because he's out of his mind. And that's what they did to Jack Ruby.
Wow. Well, now tell us about the note that you wrote to Dr. Ochsner and how that note represented a turning point in your cancer research in New Orleans.
Well, I came to New Orleans not to give people cancer, but to cure them. It says in the newspapers that Judy has been assigned to study how to make cancer more deadly. Now, isn't that something? So I, on top of everything, I already had learned about how to make cancer grow more quickly and, reproduce in animals, mice specifically. Now I'm being trained to try and use these formulas and things I learned at Roswell Park and elsewhere to make cancer grow as quickly as it could, especially melanoma.
I'm speaking with author and former cancer researcher Judith Ferry Baker. Today's show, The Cancer Bioweapon and Plot to Kill JFK. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
All right, so knowing these different things, I find myself in this position where what I thought was, well, I still had standards. When I learned that, I've been told originally there's just one prisoner and that this poor man, he had a problem. Because he had a terminal cancer. That's why I was told. So I asked Dave Ferry, well, look, I have to go out there and do this blood test on him to determine if the cancer that we injected in him took. And it has to be done within 72 hours. But, Dave, I've got a problem. What kind of cancer does he have? If he has the same kind of cancer we're getting him, I wouldn't be able to tell. And Dave says, just off the cuff, no, he's a killer and all that. He's going to die anyway, but he's perfectly healthy. You know, we're not going to electrocute him. We're going to kill him with cancer if we can. I was horrified and shocked. I mean, they're taking a man who's absolutely healthy and he's a volunteer. And eventually I realized there had to be more than one. They were taking these men, these prisoners who are volunteering for cancer research. And if it worked, what we gave them, it would kill them, and they were unaware of it. So I wrote a note to Dr. Ochsner. Now, that was forbidden. We were not to have a paper trail. If you read in Me and Lee, my book, How I Came to Know, Love, and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald, you'll learn how important it was not to have a paper trail. Lee Oswald comes as an observer, for example, when these prisoners are getting injected and when instructions are given to the clinicians on how to take care of the material, keep it alive. He's there because they don't want him to have to read anything. He has to hear it orally. He will transmit that information when he hands off the biological weapon to a medical contact, give him that information that he needs, nothing written down. Here I wrote a note. Basically, it said something like this, that it's unethical to give a disease that can cause a terminal condition in a patient who does not have such a disease. It's just unethical. And I put it in an envelope and sealed it. And when I actually went myself physically to Ochsner Clinic, handed it to the nurse there. It was vacation time. This is end of August. And the regular nurse there who knew me, she wasn't there. Instead, it was an old woman, and taking her place, obviously, because she was on vacation. And she said, looks at this envelope. She said, well, is this urgent? Because it said it's to Dr. Ochsner. I said, yes, it is. She opened it up and started to read it over the intercom. It's to Dr. Ochsner. Oh, my gosh. I got out of there as fast as I could. I knew I was dead meat. I did. I knew it. It was over. And, of course, it was. That man, when he called me on the phone, I went right to Dr. Mary's apartment hoping she'd be there. She wasn't.
Dr. Sherman, you mean?
I wanted to come. Yeah, we called her Dr. Mary. We didn't use last names and often use code names. Like on the phone, Lee was Hector. I didn't use his real name. He did things like that. It was like playing spy, you know? I mean, I didn't realize how serious it all was, not until later. I thought some of this was just to keep things quiet so people wouldn't know what we were doing. And here we're trying to kill a head of state, and I've been drawn into this project. And now I was feeling dreadful. He calls on the phone, Ochsner calls over there. I'd gone there hoping that Mary, Dr. Mary, would be a comfort to me, another woman. And he begins cursing at me. Oh, dear God. And finally, I have to have a meeting with him, and when he calls me in, not long after that, all right, he had to round me up. There were grown men who interned for him. They were in the operating room, and if one of them made a mistake or something like that, and he was very pissed off. I'm using bad words because of how bad this was. Ochsner had the ability to scream at them in such a way that some of them fainted, literally fainted. This is a man who broke his belt whipping one of his kids. Broke his belt on him. Broke it. This side of Alton Ochsner that other people haven't seen. He's also, remember, he was King Rex. He was the most popular man in town. You don't come against a man like that. This man had power. And now I'm standing before him, and his face is red. His eyes are bulging. The anger, he was seeing red. And when he burst into his imprecations against me, I just swore to myself I was going to take it. I was not going to. But, boy, when he was finished, he said, "You get out of here." And he said, "It's lucky you have your teeth in your damned head." And I turned around and left, and my career was over in 3 minutes, you see, like a boiled egg. And I came out, and there's Dave with the car that hardly ever would start on time. And car always had a run-down battery anyway. And or something was wrong with the solenoid. I come out there, and I started to cry in his arms. It's the only time Dave's ever put his arms around me. But at another point, he told me I was like the daughter he never had. He was born the same year as my dad, and I was estranged from my father. And here Dave is trying to comfort me. He said, "Well, it's all over now, isn't it?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm ruined. And they want me never to see Lee again. I've got to go back to Gainesville, Florida. But not until I do this blood test." They had nobody else on earth who could do it or be trained to do it in time. It had to be done within 72 hours. So Lee would eventually, soon drive me out there. And Dr. Oxstream gave me the papers I had to fill out for that stupid blood test. Anyway, it was over. And all the things I wanted to do to help people and help them get cancer cured, I wasn't even allowed to ever, ever, ever get into a lab again. Yet, what happened in New Orleans, and it's very important, when they send me away, in New Orleans, and here's what happened. I had to go to Florida, but they said, "Wait a minute, we've got a problem. If this woman actually... reporters are going to notice what happened in New Orleans. How come she's not doing cancer research anymore?" So they put me into Peninsula Chem Research, and I was working there as a lab assistant. I was doing lots of tests to check the purity of new chemicals, and some of them were very exotic. I was working with gas chromatography, working with lasers, doing all these kinds of tests. After that, though, it was all over, and I was ruined.
How horrible. When did you first become aware of a plot to kill the president? And how did you become aware of this plan?
Well, that happened early on. I mean, they're trying to get me to participate in creating a biological weapon against Castro. And when I walk into Dr. Sherman's apartment, she asked me to come in. There sits David Ferry. By the way, I have what they call a remarkable memory. It's right in the book there. You can see that she opens the door, and then I come in, and there is David Ferry sitting at a table. And why I mention that is that Dr. Sherman did not have a dining room. Right away when you walked in, if she's going to have a meal, where a sit-down meal, not at a counter, she had a table in the living room. And I can remember the layout of her apartment and everything. Anyway, there's Dave sitting there. And at first they talked about Mount Everest, so you can get the date right away from that. Mount Everest had been conquered that day. So, and then they turned the conversation to some political material, and finally they start talking to me about a man. They said, "This man is in real trouble because he thinks he's the president of the United States, and he has power, that he's a real president." and his baby brother's causing all kinds of trouble for the mafia, and he's causing all kinds of trouble for the oil people. And he said he's going to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces, and he's going to retire Hoover in a couple of years, and Hoover doesn't want to retire. In fact, Hoover would go on to become director for life under Lyndon Johnson. And they make this list of all the enemies that Kennedy has. They say, you know, what might stop that? Well, what would stop that? What if we got Cuba back? What if Castro was killed? Do you realize the same people who are engaged in all this talk about killing Kennedy, they all want Cuba back because they have interests. The mafia has interests. They forget all about Bobby, at least for a while, you know, getting rid of him, because they want their casinos back. They want their prostitutes back. They want their drug rings back. CIA would be able to move in and get a lot of glory by, you know, securing the Capitol and subduing and getting rid of all the communists. That would make Hoover very happy as well. He could round them all up, and whether they were communists or not, you know, and make a show of it and show how, you know, how powerful he was. We have all these United Fruit, Standard Fruit interests. We have assets there in Cuba, including oil refineries of interest to the oil guys who were losing all that. So if we can just get Cuba back, they're not going to get rid of Kennedy. They're going to be fighting over Cuba. They're going to be dividing Cuba among themselves. So this is how I was persuaded that it was a good idea to kill Castro. Frankly, it sounded pretty good to me.
So then it sounds like Dr. Mary Sherman was aware all along of a plot to assassinate Kennedy.
Well, all along, I think it all developed that they learned by at least March when we have all of a sudden you have to understand that Dr. Ochsner, who hated Kennedy, was in a peculiar position a year earlier in 1962. The man was in charge of Kennedy's visit to New Orleans, of all people. He was Dr. Ochsner. He learned so much about the motorcade. He learned about Kennedy's secret medical problems. We know that Kennedy's doctor often sat in the car with him. He'd be the third man, the man in the middle seat, the man where you wouldn't have had a bullet going and hitting Kennedy in the throat. If that man had been sitting there, he would have hit his doctor. And his doctor was placed in a car way, way back, far, far from John F. Kennedy. Mm-hmm. We know that Ochsner learned everything about the motorcade and how it's set up and the situations. He could do it because he was the doctor, and he was the one who would have to know about Kennedy's medical conditions and needs, potential problems, and so on. He is the one in charge of that motorcade. Did you know that, of that visit? So there we've got connections. We have doctors talking to doctors. We know that Dr. Ochsner's good friend is Clay Shaw, has all these interests for the international trademark. Think about the international trademark, please, for a moment, because Clay Shaw of the international trademark, we have Juan Valdez, worked for the international trademark, is the first one to report that Mary Sherman is dead. He smells smoke. Well, you know, that something's wrong at Mary Sherman's apartment. And he calls. Who does he call? Who do you call when you have fire?
Well, the fire department, you would think.
Well, no, he called the police department, which tells me a lot right there. He called the police department. He's of the international trademark. We have John F. Kennedy is on his way to the international trademark. And Clay Shaw, of course, was involved in this project to help kill Castro. So we have the situation of the death of Castro would have stopped the death of Kennedy. And Mary Sherman had learned a lot of this. She was anti-Castro to the extent she was helping some of these guerrillas out there. They're being trained. She brought the medical supplies. She actually was a contributor to INCA, the Information Council of the Americas. It was run by Ochsner and Ed Butler, and they were sending out propaganda all over Central South America, Mexico, and these were truth tapes. They were propaganda tapes, helped, partially sponsored by the CIA. I could go on and on of how deep they were involved with CIA activities.
Now, would Lee Harvey Oswald have confided in Dr. Mary Sherman about assassination plans against the president in Chicago? The Chicago business and how they saved President Kennedy in Chicago.
Yes, we'll finish with that. the Chicago plot, the way it looks now, with Mary's many contacts that she had in Chicago for years, people she trusted, also the fact that she knew people who were connected with the CIA and the FBI. There's no doubt about that. And we have someone who would have talked, and I think that's, of course, what got her killed on the 21st of July when she was found murdered the same day the Warren Commission came to get unsolicited testimonies. So we have that situation. She had the ability to get information and connect it with, also with David Ferry, put the two together. That was quite a bit of an asset because David, of course, was working for the mafia with Carlos Marcello. And, of course, he had all these contacts there with, like, Sam Giancana and so on up there in the Chicago area. And here's the plot to kill Kennedy. It's afoot. And the information is there. Lee Oswald learns about it because they can't do that directly. Lee takes it upon himself to make the calls, to make the decision to tell them. They arrest our men there. We have Abraham Bolden still in Chicago now in that same area who tells us that it was a man named Lee who gave them the information.
You mean the information to prevent an assassination of the president?
Absolutely.
In Chicago?
Yes. Yes.
Just one last clarification. Do you think that Dr. Mary Sherman was the target of the sabotage of the linear particle accelerator?
This happened the day that the Warren Commission came. They knew who she was, but unfortunately for all of us, you know, even though Dave Ferry and Lee, of course, eventually were also murdered and killed, others too, she cares about her country. And she wants to save the president if she can. You bet that something had to be done about Mary Sherman.
Judith Ferry Baker, thank you so much.
Well, I'm very pleased that I have been able to at least speak with you for a little while. God bless you, and maybe we can talk again.
I've been speaking with Judith Ferry Baker. Today's show has been The Cancer Bioweapon and Plot to Kill JFK. Judith Ferry Baker is an author, teacher, and an artist, and was once a promising young science prodigy who hoped one day to find a cure for cancer. Recruited to New Orleans in the spring of 1963 to do cancer research, she instead was assigned to an underground laboratory project to develop a cancer-causing bioweapon. Early on in the summer of 1963, during her work in New Orleans, she learned of plans to kill the president. She is the author of two nonfiction personal memoirs, Me and Lee, How I Came to Know, Love, and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald, and David Ferry, Mafia Pilot, Participant in Anti-Castro Bioweapon Plot, Friend of Lee Harvey Oswald, and Key to the JFK Assassination. Visit meandlee.com. judithbaker.blogspot.com and david-ferry.com. That's meandlee.com, judithbaker.blogspot.com, and david-ferry.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner. To make comments or order copies of shows, email me at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's FAULKNER at GUNSANDBUTTER.ORG. Visit our transitional website at gunsandbutter.org to sign up for our email list. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio. That's GANDBRADIO.
There's something happening here.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear.
Man with a gun over there. Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today we'll be taking another look at trash reuse, recycling, ecology, and whatnot. But let's circle around these topics a bit before addressing them head on. Let's look at some larger issues. Compared with, say, the Spaniards and the French, Americans are notoriously ignorant about world affairs, economics, and history. That's done on purpose and for a reason. The less the citizens know of any alternative way of doing things, the more they will see the current economic and political structures as natural and inevitable. They're not, of course. In fact, they're entirely unworkable and unsustainable. But the people who run and profit from these unsustainable systems don't want you to realize that. There is no alternative, as Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher loved saying. That brings me to one of the extremely few benefits of being 60-plus years old. You've been around long enough to remember when things were done differently, right here. And in some cases, the older system worked better than the current one. Young people are often surprised when I tell them that in 1958, say, there weren't any homeless people to speak of. Maybe 75 alcoholics on Skid Row in the Bowery. But there weren't overcrowded homeless shelters in every small town in America as there are today. Nobody died from eating spinach contaminated with E. coli, either. Died from polio, maybe, but not from spinach. Not only that, but almost everybody with a job of some kind had health insurance. The dominant health insurance company, Blue Cross Blue Shield, was a non-profit organization, and accordingly the rates were affordable. So much for progress. Let's get back to reuse and recycling. By 1958, the corporate-sponsored move to make new, sell, discard, and make more new was well underway. But a lot of vestiges of the old school remained. That is, vestiges of the World War II era. I remember trips with my father to Pop's Atlantic gas station. There you could buy a carton of Pepsi, a wooden partitioned frame that held 24 glass bottles of cola. When you were done, you brought back the frame and the 24 empty bottles and picked up a new set. The bottles would go back to the bottling plant in nearby Philadelphia, get washed out, then refilled and resold. And the carton was reused for years. Waste and burden on our landfills? Almost nothing. At least not on the consumer's end. They don't do that anymore. Bottling plants are larger, fewer, and farther away, and the cost of shipping all those glass bottles back to the plant would be high. Most bottles are now plastic. They're never refilled. Even if you put them in your recycling bin, the vast majority of the plastic is never actually recycled and made into something else. Most of it is simply shredded, shipped to the third world, and buried. How much fuel does it take to ship 1,000 tons of ground plastic to India? We heard about this a couple months back when we broadcast the documentary The Lightbulb Conspiracy. And before that, when we broadcast The Story of Bottled Water. We'll hear more about it in a few seconds when we hear another documentary. It's from 2005, and it's called Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage. The filmmaker is Heather Rogers. Once again, I'll thank Robin Upton of Unwelcome Guests for turning up another excellent video documentary. www.unwelcomeguests.net. One other memory. Decades back, you'd find the occasional good program on National Public Radio. I remember one on garbage, and particularly this item. In the eastern U.S., at the sites of 17th century settlements, archaeologists have found old glass bottles, all hand-blown, of course. The settlers would reuse the bottle for many, many years, and finally discard it when the bottom had worn through. Maybe give this a thought next time you see someone chugging a 6-ounce container of commercially bottled water and then tossing the plastic bottle into the trash. Does this add up to progress? Here's an especially interesting point today's documentary makes. The big and long-running anti-littering campaign is basically a scam funded by industry. It's designed to head off legislation that would prohibit so much disposable crap from being made in the first place by shifting the burden for our ubiquitous trash to the consumer. But the documentary starts off by exposing an even bigger scam. That's the notion that much plastic can be recycled in the first place. Let's have a listen to Heather Rogers' Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage.
Over the last 30 years, our mountains of waste have doubled, despite the much ballyhooed rise in recycling. According to the official ideology, America is getting greener. We reduce, reuse, and recycle.
When I recycle, it makes me feel good because I feel like I'm helping the environment.
I think it's great for the environment. I think it's an important thing.
I feel like I'm actually doing something for the world.
You know, it's a hip thing. It's like having a higher consciousness.
Recycling makes me feel
like you've done something.
Yeah, I'm doing my part.
If you do it that day, you're like, yeah.
When you recycle, you don't have to use this, more materials.
Recycling is good for the earth and stuff. I think recycling it works.
In reality, recycling isn't so simple. Some materials are more easily recycled than others. Some aren't recycled at all, and many recycling processes cause pollution of their own. Take plastic, for example. Only 5% of it gets recycled, and much of that goes into products that cannot in turn be recycled themselves. Each time plastic is reprocessed, its chemical bonds break down. This is called downcycling. And to overcome this, recycled plastic must be mixed with lots of virgin plastic to be of any use. Downcycling also occurs in processing used paper, and eventually, all plastic and paper is incinerated or ends up in a landfill.
At the Ecology Center, we collect all the food containers in one stream of material, in paper in a second stream of material, and it's separated by hand. Once plastic is pulled off, it gets sent to a machine, and we transport the bottles to our baler, which is similar, if you will, analogy, is like a hay baler. And these bottles are coalesced together and squeezed into a cube that weighs about 1,200 pounds. What happens is these bales are broken apart, and they sent through another machine called a granulator. And they get made into granules about the size of a BB. And at that point, that's your raw material from wherever next you send the plastic to. So it's a pretty complicated process.
All this stuff is used for a different thing. It's really weird. Okay? I guess the glass is remelted down. What happened to this? They melt it down and they make a football uniform and jerseys and sweatshirts and stuff. This stuff is valuable. They pay you 42 cents a pound for this stuff. Okay? That's a lot of money.
Plastic is growing at 7 times the rate of plastic recycling, so we're not keeping up.
One of the problems that we face is that plastics recycling has been promoted by a group called the American Plastics Council, and they're also convincing a lot of consumers that all this plastic is actually recyclable. Recycling programs operators like myself have been left literally holding the bag, trying to sell all this plastic or give it away. And to what is in essence is a fictional market.
Recycling wasn't always feel-good fraud. Throughout history, people routinely reused materials. In the 19th century, it was big business and a way of life. On Barren Island in Jamaica Bay, where much of New York City's rubbish was dumped, hundreds of people lived and worked among the refuse. Known as scow trimmers and rag pickers, they dug through piles of garbage on the island and on the barges around it. They looked for repairable household items like furniture, dishware, and textiles. They gathered up bones to make soap and fertilizer, rags to make paper, and, with the unidentified dregs left behind, they made imitation coffee and sausage to sell at boarding houses. This intensive reuse of waste continued into the 1940s, when the U.S. government encouraged the public to recycle metal and other materials as part of the war effort. In those days, a single thick glass bottle could be reused up to 40 times. But after the war, everything changed. Mass prosperity brought an explosion of a modern consumer culture based on advertising, image, and the persuasive power of brands and packaging. A new breed of garbage was born.
New. Gleam and only Gleam has the patented GL70 formula to destroy decay bacteria with just one brushing.
Well, what's the difference as long as you've got Tide?
I want this new Philco because it has adjustable shelves, and my husband likes the price tag.
By the late 50s, producers were spending as much on packaging and advertising as they spent on manufacturing. And, as the boom times wore on, markets became saturated. There was just too much stuff and not enough consumption. The trick was to keep people buying, to get the economy to metabolize more products. The strategy, built-in obsolescence.
Make your trips with baby more fun. Wherever you go, go with Playtex Driper disposable diapers.
Capitalism has an absolute imperative to push more and more things out. You know, the products of today render the products of yesterday obsolete. And that keeps everybody buying. And if people don't buy, then you can't make any money, and then accumulation slows down and you get a crisis. So you have to keep the commodities flowing. I mean, that's the absolute fundamental rule of capitalism. So there's a natural tendency towards obsolescence of a technological nature, of a fashion nature, of product design nature. There's a number of ways in which the old world will constantly be rendered obsolete. That's another aspect of capitalism's creative destruction. It isn't that it's just tearing down factories or tearing down places, but it's actually tearing down its own products.
As wages rose during the 50s, private waste haulers turned away from labor-intensive reuse and recycling practices. The new dump would use technology, like the compactor truck and the sanitary landfill. Both of these innovations had been developed during World War II by the Army Corps of Engineers. With thousands of troops concentrated together at domestic bases, managing the mess was a huge project. In fact, the Army drafted Jean Vincennes, the architect of America's first sanitary landfill, to help research methods of compressing and burying mass quantities of trash. As these technologies of war became part of daily life, even freelance scavengers were banned from the dump because they got in the way of the machines.
Once, the land seemed inexhaustible. The whole vast sweep of the American continent, 3 million square miles of the richest land on earth, a land of quiet main streets, rolling farmlands, plains, forests, and mountains. A land with elbow room, with unlimited space for our towns, our cities, and our people to grow.
What you see is on one end, you know, the modern suburb where you could just scrape away the hillsides and pay no attention to terrain. And on the other side, you could take any hole in the ground, any ravine or the edge of the San Francisco Bay, and you could dump your garbage in it, and then you could cover it over with dirt. So that's the modern landfill.
I think the important thing to remember about landfills is that they're not just an unfortunate byproduct of capitalism, they actually represent the success of capitalism. The extent to which profit has been successfully achieved is the extent to which we have more garbage to put in the landfill. What we also need to think about is the amount of labor that went into producing these products, the time that was spent making these products that were specifically designed to wear out faster than they needed to. What else could we have done with that time? What other productive, scientific, creative pursuits could we have invested that time in? What kind of society could we have created alternatively?
American industry, to save production costs, carries on a continual search for ways of keeping costs down to hold prices down, so our products can be priced to stand out
in our competitive American market.
The petrochemical revolution around World War II, we started generating a new waste stream that was heavy on plastics, heavy on synthetics, heavy on toxics. And then we discovered that, of course, once you bury it, it's leaching into the water. It's still a danger.
There's a party in every bottle of NoCal. And don't forget, for picnics and beach parties, NoCal also comes in quick-chilling, easy-to-carry cans.
In 1953, not long after disposable cans and bottles were introduced on a mass scale, Vermont's state legislature passed a law that completely banned the sale of throwaway bottles. Within months, the beverage container industry, seeing that Vermont's law would limit their profits, counterattacked. They started a group called Keep America Beautiful and thus invented corporate greenwashing.
So suddenly you get Lady Bird Johnson and others say that the problem is one of beauty rather than of potential real danger, hazard, and even a kind of malignant way of living. But you weren't going to tackle that head on, because that would mean you'd have to tackle, you know, the whole basis of consumer society, which is, you know, fundamental to modern capitalist production and to the whole way the United States works.
But while we're a responsible people with regard to our tangible resources of forests and minerals, how do we treat this important resource for recreation? We go away from home on a vacation and take a holiday from responsibility. We launch a fallout of litter. The litter problem seems to get worse. Sadly and ironically, because of scientific advances and new improvements in modern living, trash only becomes trash after it has first served a useful purpose. It becomes litter only after people thoughtlessly discard it.
So then it's about, you know, if you're not going to tackle that, what other device do you have? Well, it's to say, look at you, the individual. Don't be a bad person and throw the litter out the window. You know, so it's an individual responsibility. Do not litter. Be a good citizen.
The TV ad continues. Now it shows an American Indian in traditional dress paddling his canoe down a stream. The farther he proceeds, the more the environment is fouled by litter. The voice of the narrator may sound vaguely familiar. It belongs to the actor Ronald Reagan.
Some people have a deep, abiding respect for the natural beauty that was once this country. And some people don't. People start pollution. People can stop it.
Keep America Beautiful's campaign worked. Vermont's ban on disposables was undone, and no legislation like it has ever passed again. By the late 1960s, environmental consciousness was on the rise, triggered in part by Rachel Carson's best-selling book, Silent Spring. Though Carson focused on the toxic effects of DDT, her work also helped stimulate a return to recycling and a critique of consumerism in general. Volunteers started neighborhood recycling programs and organized the first Earth Day in 1970, where hippies coined the now ubiquitous term, reduce, reuse, recycle.
This is our constructed wetland gray water system, filters and cleans all the shower water that the house produces. You know, in the sense of recycling and reuse, the shower water goes directly into making a vegetable garden. What we do here is dump our food wastes in here, and there's red worms underneath here, and red worms go ahead and chomp away at the food. This was probably dumped maybe about a week ago, and it was straight up food waste before, and obviously it's being made into soil right now. This, essentially here, is sort of, while it looks just like a table, it's actually a compost toilet. You go in there until it fills up, and then you can pull the bucket out and take it over to the hot pile compost and dump it and process it. It makes sense that, you know, just like we use the worm casting, so we can use human excrement, if composted well, to make nice soil.
When we salvage for reuse and we save something in its already manufactured form, we conserve both the material and the cultural value and the energy that went into producing the object. Now, if the same object is shredded up and bashed and remanufactured into something new, it's good for it to be recycled. But it isn't nearly as good as if that value had been conserved in the first place by reusing the object as is. You have to use all the resources that you've taken out of the wild. You have to use them as long as you can. And you can't just dig a hole in the ground and bury them.
Today, there are over 9,000 curbside recycling programs in the U.S. More Americans recycle than vote. But for all this, the mountains of garbage continue to grow. An industry's role in waste production, to some extent, remains hidden. Consider this. For every ton of household trash, more than 70 tons of waste are produced by industries like manufacturing, mining, agriculture, and petrochemicals.
Capital's only relation to nature is ultimately its relation to accumulation. But the technological power is so great now that that law of accumulation can mean a law of destruction of the earth and of life on earth at a scale never before seen. Unless society, human beings, thinking human beings, intervene to say our only relationship to nature cannot just be accumulation and profit. It has to be that we live on this earth, that we do not destroy this earth, that the beautiful things of the earth are maintained. The only way you can do that is to stop capitalism, to say, no, here you may not go, here you may not dig, here you may not transform, here you may not alter your gene pool, here you may not pollute the atmosphere, here you may not burn natural fossil fuels. Social regulation is an inherent part, a necessary part of social life under modern production. And if you don't regulate it, the market misbehaves, the companies misbehave, and you can, you know, drown in your own ways.
So ends, rather abruptly, The Hidden Life of Garbage. If you've been listening to this show for the past 6 months, you've probably already learned that most of the plastic that you recycle never actually gets recycled. So why are most of us going through this elaborate charade of paying a nickel deposit on each beverage bottle, then afterwards rinsing the empty and returning it to the store? Since most of it ends up in a landfill anyway, right next to all the other plastic you place in your recycle bin. Answer, because this charade keeps you off the backs of the manufacturers. They remain free to continue polluting the environment with zillions of tons of disposable crap. It's been less than a year since I first learned that most recycling, in fact, doesn't recycle much. I was as surprised as anybody at first, but every good source I've seen since has confirmed the fact. I shouldn't have been so naive, but I was surprised again when this week's documentary exposed that the huge Keep America Beautiful anti-litter campaign was another industry-sponsored PR ploy designed to increase profits at the expense of the environment. If you have any doubts, consider the casting of the old ad we heard. Now, if they had gotten an ecologist like Rachel Carson or Ewell Gibbons or Bill McKibben to narrate it, that would have been one thing. I suspect that, if they had been asked, all three would have told the ad agency to go pound sand. The fact that they hired that old hack and corporate pitchman Ronald Reagan as narrator tells you all you need to know about the purposes of the campaign. For a complimentary view, Let's hear again just a couple of minutes of Annie Leonard's The Story of Bottled Water.
In a recent full-page ad, Nestle said, "Bottled water is the most environmentally responsible consumer product in the world." What? They are trashing the environment all along the product's life cycle. Exactly how is that environmentally responsible? The problems start here with extraction and production, where oil is used to make water bottles. Each year, making the plastic water bottles used in the U.S. takes enough oil and energy to fuel a million cars. All that energy spent to make the bottle, even more to ship it around the planet, and then we drink it in about 2 minutes? That brings us to the big problem at the other end of the life cycle, disposal. What happens to all these bottles when we're done? 80% end up in landfills, where they will sit for thousands of years, or in incinerators, where they are burned, releasing toxic pollution. The rest gets collected for recycling. I was curious about where the plastic bottles that I put in the recycling bins go. I found out that shiploads were being sent to India, so I went there. I will never forget riding over a hill outside Madras, where I came face to face with a mountain of plastic bottles from California. Now, real recycling would turn these bottles back into bottles. But that wasn't what was happening here. Instead, these bottles were slated to be downcycled, which means turning them into lower quality products that would just be chucked later. The parts that couldn't be downcycled were thrown away there, shipped all the way to India just to be dumped in someone else's backyard. If bottled water companies want to use mountains on their labels, it would be more accurate to show one of these mountains of plastic waste. Scaring us, seducing us, and misleading us. These strategies are all core parts of manufacturing demand.
Thanks for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. To send feedback, to learn more about the show, or whatever, check out our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. That's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non-carborundum, keep giving all you can, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And with me is Phil Conlon.
Hi, yes, good afternoon, Phil.
World Series is done. We can get back to work.
Yeah.
That's it. Thanks to the manager. Thanks to the courageous pitcher and turning it all into a terrible joke on the Mets. We're going to be talking today to Thomas Mountain, the man on the, from the mountain in Eritrea. And we'll be speaking about his article, which you can find on the web and at Counterpunch, Benghazi Smokescreen, Hiding Western War Crimes in Libya. And at the halfway point, we're going to be talking with Isaac Saini, who is Professor Dalhousie, and there's an important conference coming up on November the 13th and 14th at the Steelworkers Hall. Better mentioned, we're getting ready for fundraising, so if you want to membership drive.
Membership drive.
It is our membership. This is your big chance.
It starts next Monday.
Next Monday we're starting, and so Taylor Report is
Go to the website now, CIUT.FM. You can actually, you don't have to wait till next Monday. You can make your donation now. You can buy a membership now if you haven't already done so this year. And we have a goal to make, and please help us make it.
This is community radio, people. It belongs to you. And so you can start, as Phil says, just go to CIUT.FM, get all the information you need to know there. What you need to know here is that we want you to mention the Taylor Report and, list that, put a little check mark behind the Taylor Report. And, of course, Phil Conlon is here. And Wednesdays, 6 to 8 o'clock, Classical Underground. So there
yes,
again.
Thanks for the plug. It. Yes, yeah. Please mention us as well.
Yeah. Well, it's a community. Yeah. You know, we all get our 2 cents worth in. We're waiting to speak with Thomas Mountain. I'll just tell you, the Toronto Star goes to so much trouble to misinform everybody that I want to call attention that today they outdid themselves. They interviewed – the way to understand the new serious situation is to interview a guy who's wanted for tax evasion in Russia. And he's – the headline on the piece is Russia driven by economic fears. And he said – and they say military activity in Syria is aimed at easing sanctions, claims critic Bill Browder. Phil Conlon is remembering Earl Browder. But anyhow – here's the problem with this. He's explaining to us why Russia is in Syria. And he says, well, it's really money. Well, then maybe he could help us out with why is the U.S. in Syria? Why are they bombing? Would that have anything to do with money? Apparently not. And then alongside the article, they have a second headline that, again, is laughable. It's called The Islamic State Group Advances in Syria. And the Toronto Star is almost happy about that. Just this last comment on that, it's very interesting. They're writing about what they call advances by ISIS in Syria, and they've dropped the expression terrorist. There are no terrorists anymore. These now ISIS is the militant opposition, and the Toronto Star doesn't explain why they've decided to change the our terminology. Anyway, reference Orwell, and you can look it up. Thomas Mountain is with us now. Are you there, Thomas?
Yes, I am, Phil.
I'm sorry we kept you up, but they've invented something called daylight saving time, which has really made it more difficult. You are, of course, in Eritrea, and we're really glad to be talking to you because you've gone into what has been a headline story in North America now for 2 weeks. So that's the great war between the Republicans and Hillary Clinton and her emails and what happened in Benghazi. And you, in my view, correctly identified the problem. It's actually this whole thing's a smokescreen. Why is it a smokescreen? Talk about that.
Well, you know, the whole war in Libya was actually the lies used to justify the war in Libya were worse than the lies used to justify the invasion of Iraq. I mean, we have to remember before Osama bin Laden, before ISIS, there was Al Qaeda. Before Al Qaeda, there was Saddam Hussein, and before Saddam Hussein, there was Muammar Gaddafi, in terms of the devil, convenient devil of the moment. And they invaded Iraq. The United States and its allies invaded Iraq on completely fraudulent conditions. But it was worse in Libya, because in the case of Libya, everything told about all the reasons used to justify the war were complete fabrications. First of all, we had Hillary Clinton back in 2011 pronouncing that Gaddafi was giving Viagra to black mercenaries to rape Arab women.
Yes.
And that Gaddafi was bombing the population of Benghazi in the rebellion against him. Well, thanks to Donatello Rovere, who was a senior Amnesty International investigator, who arrived in Benghazi a week after the rebellion in Libya broke out in 2011, there was not a single aerial bombardment of anyone by the Gaddafi Air Force in the entire rebellion. There was no aerial bombardment. So the whole
he was not killing his own people, as President Obama kept claiming.
That's right. 10,000. Gaddafi slaughtered 10,000 of his own people. Well, it turns out, up until the time that the U.S. and its allies instigated the no-fly zone, in other words, started bombing Libya, there'd only been 110 people killed in Benghazi and its environment. 110 only, and that included Gaddafi supporters, whereas Hillary Clinton and the lot were claiming that Gaddafi had already killed 10,000 people. There's going to be a mass genocide if the West didn't intervene. So there was no African mercenaries. They've never been able to produce one African mercenary. Mm-hmm. They haven't been able to produce one woman that was raped. Not one woman that was raped. They were saying thousands of people were raped. Hillary Clinton said Gaddafi was giving Viagra to his black African mercenary to rape Arab women.
Yeah, and this is Thomas Mountain. Thomas, if I recall, and this is really kind of important for understanding how colonialism, neocolonialism works, the International Criminal Tribunal, International Criminal Court, the prosecutor helped with tell that lie. Am I right?
Yes, the infamous Spanish prosecutor who was supposed to have been such a defender of human rights got up there and said the same thing. So it was just a unanimous condemnation of Gaddafi with all fabrications.
Mm-hmm.
No aerial bombardments, no black African mercenaries, and no rapes. All the reasons told to justify the war in Libya were complete fabrication. And they destroyed Libya, and who was the winner? The big winner in the war in Libya was, once again, religious fanatics, in this case, one Belhaj, who is now the caliph of a large chunk of North Africa that was formerly part of Libya. Mm-hmm. Now, Belhaj is a very interesting character because he had been the head of one of the heads of the Al-Qaeda in Iraq back after the U.S. invasion. He'd come from Libya to fight in Iraq and spent his time not fighting the Americans who invaded Iraq, but organizing suicide bombers to attack Shia marketplaces and Shia mosques and religious gatherings.
Mm-hmm.
And thousands and thousands, untold thousands of Shia were slaughtered by suicide bombers organized by one Belhaj, a Libyan fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
He had been run out of Libya, run out of Libya and run out of Iraq, and arrested in Malaysia and returned back to Libya, where Gaddafi had put him in prison.
Yeah, by the way, Gaddafi, one of these things people need to appreciate, Gaddafi was part of what he thought was an international effort to combat terrorists, and they would agreed that this is a bad guy, he should be put away. But immediately the West turned on Gaddafi and said, no, you have to release him, didn't they?
Well, actually, Gaddafi's son, Islam al-Saif al-Islam, oldest son, had arranged basically a pardon or a parole for Belhaj in exchange for Belhaj giving his word, his sacred word, that he wouldn't take up arms against the government of Libya. And Belhaj was released on parole, and as soon as the rebellion broke out, which was shortly after this release, Belhaj took up arms against Gaddafi. So, then they portrayed Belhaj, the Western media portrayed Belhaj as a moderate, as somebody that had been reformed.
That's a familiar.
He's an anti-Gaddafi. He's an anti-Gaddafi patriot. And this guy was somebody we should support. I remember watching him on an Al Jazeera interview saying how, yes, he never was that nasty guy they claimed he was, and that seen the light, and he was going to change his ways. And now that the government is, you know, the Gaddafi government has bombed him to the dust, and Gaddafi himself murdered, Al-Haj has now turned around and set up basically an Islamic state in Libya, where about a third of Libya and a growing portion of Libya, expanding portion of Libya, is now run by Al-Haj and the Islamic State. And this is the main big winner from the war in Libya, was, once again, is religious extremism.
Yeah. And, well, as you point out, it's also a source of arms. You mentioned a couple of times in your article, by the way, this is Thomas Mountain, and the article is Benghazi Smokescreen, Hiding Western War Crimes in Libya. They've gone on to be the kind of an armory and, I guess, trainer for terrorist operations in Africa.
Yes, it's the safe haven. The big chunk of Libya is safe haven now for terrorism. And, you know, the whole expansion of the extremist movement in Nigeria has been fueled by arms shipped from Libya. And who's shipping those arms? Most certainly Al-Haj, because Al-Haj is allies of the Boko Haram extremist movement in Nigeria. Not just in Nigeria, it's expanded into Chad and Cameroon as well.
Yes. So, and some of the arms... Al-Haj, go on, sorry.
No, go ahead.
The Syria, they've also provided personnel and weapons in Syria over the past 3-4 years.
Well, that's what the so-called four dead American diplomats and their consulate or whatever it was, headquarters in Benghazi, were up to. They had been arranging the transfer of massive amounts of Libyan arms to the terrorists in Syria. Mm-hmm. And then the terrorists themselves in Libya rose up against them and attacked the compound and ended up killing 4 Americans. Mm-hmm. So this huge smokescreen has been created to talk about, well, you know, what was the problem? What, you know, failures of intelligence, or Hillary Clinton should have known better, or anything but the fact that the very act of killing the Americans was a direct result of the Americans' war in Libya, which was completely unjustified, illegal, immoral, and a war crime.
Yeah, indeed, and it came under this rubric of no-fly zone, which Hillary is now, I'm strangely and crazily enough, repeating in her political rhetoric today of a no-fly zone for Syria, she and Brzezinski and other half-mad people, McCain. But you mentioned that was pretty much the end of the road of any credibility for that, because can you remind us of what the no-fly zone was supposed to be and what it became?
Yeah, just like there was a no-fly zone in Iraq where they were using the excuse back before the invasion in 2003. For years before the invasion, under Bill Clinton, they were bombing. The United States was carrying out almost daily bombardments of Iraq and the excuse of a no-fly zone all across Iraq. Mm-hmm. So the whole history of this no-fly zone has been one of, it's just an excuse for them to come in and wage war, aerial warfare.
Mm-hmm. This is Thomas Mountain. This issue of blame of the story you pointed out that they began with, which they had to save the Libyan women from the Africans, etc. The other side to that is what has happened to any African living in Libya. Could you talk about that? Because there's a consequence of telling lies that big.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, the amazing thing is that Barack Obama was, you know, he was supporting the lynching of black Africans in Libya. Historically, for many, many years, since when you and I were back in Libya in 1987 together, part of the peace delegation, commemorate the first anniversary of the bombing of Libya in 1986, mm-hmm. Africans have been doing the dirty work, black Africans have been doing the dirty work in Libya. Now, it's sort of a backward nature. There's much of the Arab society that certain jobs like mechanics and other jobs like that are too dirty for a decent Arab man to do. Mm-hmm. They've imported Africans for many, many years, as well as Filipinos and others, to do the dirty jobs in Libya, because Libya was a very rich country. Mm-hmm. And the Libyans didn't have to do this dirty work. They could pay Africans and others to do it for them. So there were a lot of thousands and tens of thousands of black Africans in Libya working in the Libyan economy, playing a critical role in the Libyan economy. And when the racist Arab militias were given support of the Americans and the Western military, what did they do? They turned around and started lynching black Africans in Libya. Mm-hmm. So it was this really sick spectacle of Barack Obama supporting the lynching of black Africans in Libya, which included many, many Eritreans from where I live who had been working in Libya, whose burned and mutilated bodies were, where they were strangled and hung off of bridges and dumped in the desert and burned. Very similar. Was it Libya or was it Louisiana? I mean, this is doing lynching Africans in Libya.
It's the same.
Barack Obama, the black American president, was supporting this.
Yeah, the same trope. From the beginning of the Republic, they would recognize some of the methods. We're speaking to Thomas Mountain. By the way, Thomas Mountain's an independent journalist living and reporting from Eritrea since 2006, and he can be reached via Twitter at Thomas Mountain. Just Thomas Mountain.
Well, Thomas C. Mountain.
Yeah,
Thomas C. Mountain.
I better get Thomas the C in there, and they'll never reach you. You're right. And he's on Facebook, Thomas Mountain, or via email.
Thomas C. Mountain.
Yeah.
Thomas C. Mountain. If you don't get the C in there, you won't get me.
Yeah, you've introduced it. Right. Since I've known you, we've added a C to your name. Thomas C. Mountain. And, of course, it's also thomasmountain@gmail.com. Now, going back to this beginning of this, it's also striking, is it not, that the whole idea that why it's all so important to the American Congress to pillory Hillary is because one or two white Americans got harmed in the aftermath of all that went on. Isn't it? I mean, otherwise the Congress wouldn't care, right?
Right, and the irony of all that is that the Americans that were, the four Americans that were basically suffocated to death in the basement of their compound in Benghazi were all involved in very illegal and extremely dangerous activity of shipping weapons in Libya to ISIS in Syria. So these guys weren't just some innocent American diplomats that had caught in a crossfire. They were actually out there organizing the shipment of weapons to terrorists.
Yes,
and so they should have been pilloried for that. Instead, they turned into heroes. And they're saying, oh, Hillary is responsible for these heroes' deaths. Mm-hmm. Well, they're actually a bunch of criminals engaged in an activity which has resulted in thousands of people being killed in Syria.
Yeah. My memory is that they were using the term embassy when in fact it was not an embassy. It was a safe house, so-called, that became unsafe.
That's right. That's the thing. And the whole situation was basically a dodgy lot of terrorist supporters and people that were directly implicated in the support of terrorism by providing them with arms. People that, were supposed to be the enemies of the United States were getting weapons from the U.S. government, and the people who were providing them were actually the senior diplomat, the ambassador to Libya.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys got suffocated to death in the basement of the safe house and turned into heroes. When in reality, these guys were doing something that everybody should be sickened by.
Yes. Well, and things to be sick about, you also point out in the article, not discussed enough, is we've also developed this now demonology in reference to Mr. Gaddafi. But in fact, as you say in the article, Libya was not only a wealthy country, but it was rather exemplary. And that was the greatest tragedy, is the loss of it. Could you just sketch out some of the things about Libya that had been accomplished and that people should remember?
Well, Libya was the relative island of religious tolerance in an island surrounded by neighbors with large extremist movements, fighting larger wars against larger extremist movements. I mean, Algeria, you know, in the 1990s, 200,000 people died in Algeria, where the basically a forerunner of the Islamic State, you know, the forefathers of the Islamic State, were fighting this Algerian government. You know, there's thousands and thousands of Tunisians who fled to Tunisia to go fight on behalf of the Islamic State in Iraq and in Syria. Yeah. You know, Egypt has been fighting off and on war against religious fanatics for many, many years. You know, Libya was the one place that basically people got along, where there was a Shia population in Libya. Mm-hmm. There was even a Sufi population in Libya. Mm-hmm. You know, Libya was a place where they didn't tolerate religious fanaticism, and in general, the people were quite tolerant because the Gaddafi government put religious fanatics where they belonged, in prison, mm-hmm. which they've since been condemned all as a dictatorship. Why? Because they put Belhaj and his Al-Qaeda guys in prison. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we do the same thing here in Eritrea. We don't allow religious fanatics in Eritrea. I mean, whether they're born-again Christians coming in here and saying worship of Islam is the worship of the devil, or whether it's Osama bin Laden coming in saying we need to have an Islamic State here. Mm-hmm. You want to come to Eritrea and preach religious violence and hatred? They put you in prison. We're not going to tolerate that here. Half mm-hmm. our country is Muslim, half is Christian. We're not going to tolerate religious, you know, hate speech. Mm-hmm. But Gaddafi didn't tolerate that either. And mm-hmm. He was widely condemned for that. But Libya was basically, in terms of what was going on in the neighborhood in North Africa, Libya was probably one of the places where religions were most tolerated. Mm-hmm. And there was less religious friction than any of its neighbors.
Yeah, and he had he was an Arab leader who identified himself as also an African.
Well, yeah, that was something he came to later on in life. But yes, he would talk about when we were in Libya. Remember, we were given the Green Book and told about the Arab Jamahiriya, where they were going to unite all the Arabs into one nation. Mm-hmm. And after a while, Gaddafi saw that wasn't working and that wasn't going to work, and, you know, extended an olive branch and a hand of friendship to his African brothers and sisters, and was actually in the midst of doing something very, very positive for Africa, which was setting up the African Investment Bank, where he put $40 billion into U.S. bank account. And it's interesting how the Benghazi hearings never once mentioned the fact that Hillary had rolled out the red carpet for Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, just not that long before the war broke out in Libya, and the United States started bombing Libya and demonizing the Gaddafi family. And because he'd put his $40 billion in American account, and he was become friends with the United States. Yeah. So, you know, not a mention of all this Hillary schmoozing it with Saif al-Islam.
So then they took his life, and then they took his money.
Well, they took the $40 billion, and today it's still frozen in American accounts, as far as I can tell. They won't release it to this so-called government in Libya. Yeah. But, you know, what's Gaddafi going to do with that $40 billion? He was going to provide interest-free or low-interest long-term loans to African countries to build infrastructure. He was going to build a railroad from North Africa all the way to South Africa and from East Africa all the way to West Africa. Mm-hmm. He was going to put billions of dollars into upgrading the energy infrastructure in South Africa so that the people could actually have electricity on a reliable basis. He was going to do a lot of things that basically was going to kick the Western financial terrorists like the World Bank and the IMF out of Africa and allow Africa to develop itself without having to be preyed upon by predatory loans by these Western terrorist organizations like the World Bank and the IMF.
Yep.
So Gaddafi was actually about to launch a major investment program in Africa, which was going to help Africa pull itself out of this really being on its knees as an economy to Western countries. And it's one of the reasons why I'm convinced, and many people are convinced, the West went in and destroyed Libya, was to prevent the West from losing control of Africa via the African Investment Bank, which Gaddafi was about to fund.
Yeah, that's a really important story. And I'm glad you, by the way, of course, you reference it in your article. We've been speaking with Thomas Mountain, And in the title of the article, you find it Counterpunch and elsewhere on the net, Benghazi smokescreen, hiding Western war crimes in Libya. Thomas, it's a great pleasure talking to you. I'm sorry we had to keep you up late in Eritrea.
No problem, Phil. Good to be back. Man. It's almost 6 years since I've been on your show.
Yeah, you're a veteran.
I want to say all the leaders out there. Yeah, you know, these leaders, all your listeners out there, you guys, you know, it comes time to raise funds for the Taylor Report. Dig deep, because there's very few opportunities to hear the truth about what's going on. And Phil Taylor and his report has been going on for years now. It's one of the few places to do so. So I urge all your listeners out there, you know, when it comes time to give, support the Taylor Report, okay?
I let you. You notice I didn't interrupt at all. Thank you very much, Thomas. We'll talk.
Okay, Phil.
Okay. Bye bye. By golly, Thomas Mountain, remind us. We will be doing this. So go to CIUT.fm and support the Taylor Report. Next Monday, we will be out of hot and heavy. We'll be working on this steadily. And Thomas is, yes, one of our regular guests here. You know, he's there, Eritrea, right cheek by jowl with the Yemen, where there is bombings going on daily. The Toronto Star doesn't choose to talk about it, and the Globe and others. But the government of Saudi Arabia, the richest government in the Middle East, is bombing Yemen, the poorest. And everybody seems to think that's just fine because all the monarchs think it's a good idea. And the people of Yemen, who are not monarchists, are objecting. My guess is the poor will beat the rich. That's just how it works. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT.FM. You can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. .fm. And of course, we're on let me get my Facebook / The Taylor Report. I will just tell you that on the 9th, and that'll be next Monday, we're going to be asking you to support community radio and become members of CIUT. Listen, think about how many places can say community radio. It is a very healthy phenomenon. We don't rely on Pepsi-Cola or even Coca-Cola or the World Bank or anybody else. It's because the community wants to have radio. And that way they don't have to be filtered like I do. If I want to watch football, I actually have to watch commercials interrupted by football. And, you know, it gets to be pathetic, doesn't it, Phil? You watch.
Oh, yeah. It's terrible. Isn't it? You know, there are certain commercials they play over and over again, and you start going mad. You say, but I want to see the game, so you put up with it. Yeah. But it's really – it's oppressive.
Don't you sometimes have trouble remembering what was happening? You know, you come back.
Yeah. Oh, is that commercial again? Or the commercial gets into your head, and yes. It's like it pushes the game out, right? Which is even worse, right?
Yes. It introduces – and I have to say periodically the commercial, it turns out to have blocked one of the plays that I wanted to see. You come back and it's already going on, and you say – oh, thanks a lot.
And that happened in the World Series the last couple of days. It happened a couple of times.
Yeah, where you come back and the guy is pitching or, you know, it's – well, that's what capitalism will do. But this is community radio. This belongs to you. And so make sure that you support the Taylor Report and Classical Underground and such.
And don't forget CIT Friday morning, where we have scintillating discussion every Friday morning at 9 o'clock.
Last Friday, we were talking to Lynn Slotkin, had as a guest one of the greatest actresses in the world, Fiona Reid. And I don't know if it's letting you be out of secret, but she told us she's a Giants fan. So there you go. So just snippets, you see. But that is great. It's great radio. That was a great interview with Fiona Reid and with John Shute, I believe it was, the director. And so that's what, again. And the other thing that, you know, community radio gives is time to think, as opposed to, you know, carving it up so that you hear a voice of a famous person for about maybe a minute and 30 seconds. I mean, their time, when you think about it, people say, oh, he gave an interview. And you look at that interview, a long interview is 3 minutes. That's how – and you say, well, how could anybody digest that? We're going to take a break, and we will come back. We have an interview with Isaac Saney about this event coming up on November 13, 14 at the Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street. It begins at 7 o'clock on November the 13th, and we'll be on the on 9:30 a.m. on the 14th. Incidentally, there's going to be a film about what the political turmoil in Burkina Faso, where they finally got rid of a junta boss.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Well, that exuberant piece from one of the townships in South Africa, I had the good fortune of coming upon this rally when I was there and just recorded it. And I thought it was a great way to usher in our next guest. Tekufu Zuberi is professor of race relations, sociology, and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. He is a host of one of my favorite series, the PBS series History Detectives, and his epic story of modern Africa and its impact on the world emerge as an award-winning documentary and companion book about the complex continent and its dramatic fight for freedom. And we fondly welcome Professor Zuberi.
Thank you very, very much. It is my pleasure to join you.
Well, it is my pleasure to have gone through African Independence, How Africa Shapes the World, the book that accompanies the film. And instantaneously, I was joyed, if nothing else, and there is much else, by the name itself, because the importance of Africa in the world is you're an iconoclast, as I told you. You're kind of breaking with the Eurocentric flow that the center of the universe is Eurocentricity, and that everything flows from that. And you have invested Africa, the African continent, and the independence struggles with critical importance in how they shape the world. And I'm delighted. I think it's fantastic material and would like to know what prompted you to produce the film and the book towards that end of showing the centrality of African independence and how it has influenced the rest of the world.
Thank you for this opportunity. You know, for me, it is very important for us to understand what it means to be a human being, because it in itself determines how we treat each other, how we treat people who are different than we are, and what we expect from other people. That is, how do we expect them to treat us? And I do believe that there are historical moments in which the courage of the spirit of a people, the activities of a people, transform our ideas about what it means to be a human being. Africa was a great continent before European colonialism. Africa was a great continent before European enslavement and Arab enslavement. And when I say Africa was a great continent, what I mean is that there were a number of African societies that existed before European colonialism, before European enslavement. The processes of enslavement and colonialism were a long process of undefining the humanity of Africans. And by doing so, undefining the humanity of Europeans, of white people, because white supremacy, more than anything, is a statement against humanity. The African independence movement unseated classical European colonialism on the African continent. It ended it. African nations flew flags in order to displace the colonial flags of Britain, of France, of Portugal, of every colonial country on the African continent. They were displaced, and Africans placed flags of independence, and they began to run the political apparatuses of the state. In doing this very simple act of Africans having nations all over the continent. No longer was it just Ethiopia with its shining flag of independence and its whole legacy and history of independence. No longer was it simply Liberia with its long mixed history with its relationship with the United States and the way that the state was created on the west coast of Africa. Now you had independent states all over the continent. By doing that, they redefined what it means to be a human being. So that even when Martin Luther King Jr. visited the inauguration of Kwame Nkrumah in 1957 in Ghana, on his return to the United States, he had to say, we need to reconsider this idea about the birth of nations and what it means. And we need to reconsider the objectives we have in our movement. This is on the heels of the success of the Montgomery boycott, when he would say, we need to reconsider what we will do now. Is it enough to be on the bus? Is it enough to ride on the bus? We need to consider our things. And this came from looking at the African independence movement, because Africans had taken over the reins of state. Africans were demanding a different place for everyone. And by doing that, they influenced people's identity, who they were in every corner of the world. Because in every corner of the world, everyone had been taught that Africans were less than human. And this very act of declaring independence, fighting for it, creating states, and starting off all of these states in a very successful space was contrary to every lie that had been told about African people. And we need to know what we need to celebrate about Africa. It is not just disease and poverty. And everything we have done was not just during the period when there was Egypt. It was not just done in the ancient past. Sometimes Africans rescue ourselves, and by that very act, establish a new course for humanity.
You know, Professor, one of the things that I was thinking as you were speaking now was, in my personal experience, you mentioned Martin Luther King, the liberation struggles, the struggles for independence, the many groups in Angola and so many other parts of the continent, the essence of their struggle for self-determination informed the Black Liberation Movement here, the efforts for self-determination, and people such as myself took heart and inspiration for efforts to reform a society as there was a break with colonialism in a far more progressive, holistic, democratic fashion than we saw here. So to me, the contributions for building the civil rights movement, for building the Black Power movement, were really insurmountable.
But, you know, the thing is that if we take a look at the latter part of the 20th century, we find a space in which we can see that Africa and the response to Africa is leading so much. I mean, World War II is one of those defining moments in the 20th century. The defeat of Nazism crushed an old aspiration of racial superiority reigning on planet Earth. World War II could not have been won but for the efforts of African soldiers. Like the African Americans who fought on the side of the U.S. in World War II for the purpose of extending democracy. That is why African Americans were fighting. They weren't fighting to preserve segregation and extend racial lynching and the racial murder, which people saw every day in the streets. They were fighting to extend democracy and expected to return to continue receiving the benefits from what their labor had demonstrated, which is that African people from the United States were participating in a process that would revitalize their citizenship in the U.S. So too did Africans come from the various colonies on the African continent and fight in the military of the French, fight in the military of the British for the liberation of democracy, for the stopping of Nazi fascism, of Italian fascism, of Japanese fascism. So yes, African soldiers fought on the African continent against the fascist axis of Germany, Italy, and Japan. African soldiers fought in Asia against the original axis of evil. So Africans fought in this war in order to preserve democracy. After they fought, they returned home to the same old negative racist colonialism. And by returning home to this colonialism, they witnessed firsthand that the contradiction of fighting for democracy and liberating Europe and then returning home to colonialism were untenable. They could not suffer the foolishness of European colonialism any longer. And so we saw those soldiers return and protesting in the streets against the racism of Britain, protesting because in some cases the British or the French didn't even want to pay the veterans a proper kind of wage or to give them a severance pay for the end of their time in the military or to give them all of the stuff that soldiers are used to once they go and save the nation. So here they had saved the empire and they returned home not to be treated as full human beings and begin the process of fighting for African independence. The soldiers coming back. Meanwhile, Africans all over the world also begin fighting for African independence, fighting in Britain, fighting in France, as well as fighting on the African continent in every single space that was colonized, whether the colonizer was Portuguese, the French, or the British. The people begin to fight, and they fought. And they fought, and they organized, they built organizations which led political movements, which began the process first of negotiating independence and then of militaristically fighting in armed struggle for those last vestiges of colonialism that were too stubborn to leave as a consequence of negotiation and only left as a consequence of armed resistance, leading all the way up to the last armed movement to fight. fight for independence against a European colonial power, and that was in South Africa in 1994, where Africans finally gained access to the political apparatus of the society, and they were successful in bringing independence to South Africa. And as a consequence of their bringing independence in 1994 to reignite the fight for democracy throughout the African continent. And that struggle continues today.
Well, let's take it to today. And again, we're speaking with Professor Tekufu Zuberi. Let's take it through today. Where would you say that the struggle for African independence takes us in looking at Africa shaping world events now?
It's really important to understand that there is a certain mindset that you have to have when you give all credit for life to someone else. If you say that someone else is because you are alive, because and they're the cause for you breathing, they're the cause for your life, you have to understand that that is a certain type of marginalizing your own agency. That is a certain way of empowering the person that you are giving that credit to. It's kind of like when people say, oh, capitalism, yes, capitalism, that's the white man's system. They built that starting in the 19th century. They didn't pick cotton. They didn't tote no bales. They did not pick sugar. They did not give free labor that would establish the economic basis for what capitalism would be. That's why when W.E.B. Du Bois wrote a very important book called Black Reconstruction, which was, you know, a book about the effort of black people in the United States to reconstruct democracy to be real in the United States during the Civil War, which is the same thing that the Africans in South Africa did. That is, they fought a war to reconstruct democracy in order to find more full participation for the Africans and therefore change the space. Well, that effort to transform democracy is what created democracy. You don't even have a notion of what freedom is in the United States, but from those efforts of those Africans. The real story of freedom in the U.S. is written on the bodies of African and indigenous people, of indentured servants in the United States. And as those people overcome the tyranny of what democracy was by those people who wrote the lies that became the basis for the U.S. Constitution. So that here you have an effort to redefine what it means to be a human being in order to transform what it means to be a citizen in the society. And that's what Africans did in the African independence movement, and that's what Africans did in the fight against enslavement, in the fight for civil rights, in the fight for black power. And that is the efforts that people are engaged in Brazil, in Colombia, in Ecuador, as they also fight for black power in those white supremacist states as well. So now when we look at what are the implications of the African independence movement today, besides that inspiration of fighting to redefine what it means to be a human and having a profound impact on the civil rights movement, a profound impact on the black power movement in the United States, a profound impact on the black power movement in Brazil today, on a profound impact on the black power movement in Colombia today, profound impacts on all of the Caribbean states, all of the struggles in Europe that black people were engaged in. What impact does it have on us today? The African independence movement redefined the political map of Africa so that the post-independent map of Africa looks dramatically different from the colonial map when colonialism was finally consolidated around the African continent, which really occurred around 1914. So, you know, colonialism as a political system consolidated itself between 1880 and 1914 on the African continent. And then it didn't take Africans very long to begin the process of struggling against that. In fact, as soon as it popped up, wherever it popped up, you find Africans in opposition to it. after the successful political independence on the African continent, every African nation was confronted with a series of problems. And you can probably look at them and think of them in three generalizable points, which really touch on a whole host of issues. But the issue of independence in Africa has always been connected to unity on the African continent, unity of African people, unity of African groups, unity of African nations. But what Africans inherited from colonialism was a tradition of ethnic and religious conflict, which was manipulated by the colonial powers in order to keep Africans colonized, to keep Africans with an enslaved mentality, because these groups were pitted against each other in a very powerful way. And the powerful way that they were pitted against each other is that the power of the colonial masters was not really by having a large military force to enforce its reign in the country. It was by convincing a lot of Africans to fight on the side of the European colonialists, to join the European colonial militaries, to join the European colonial police forces. So Africans began to police the society and to enforce these ideas of ethnic and religious difference in a way that made them conflicting. That is, I don't want to suggest at all that the Wolof did not exist before colonialism, because they did. They did. The Zulus existed before Europeans arrived in the 15th century. African ethnic groups existed. The Igbo existed before the Europeans arrived. The Yoruba existed before the Europeans arrived. The Ashanti existed before the Europeans arrived. However, they were all changed and transformed by the system of colonialism. This change and transformation was to pit them against each other in ways that would not allow them to see their common destiny. Now, this, on top of a kind of problem, which is establishing the legitimacy of the state. And so the conflict and the lack of unity and the ethnic and religious tensions that you see on the African continent are, in fact, a result of African agency, but they have an origin in a manipulation by European colonial powers to leave a legacy of conflict and instability on the African continent. You will only be able to fight yourself if you cannot see your commonness with your neighbor. If you feel that you need to fight them because they do not believe in your religion, or that their ethnic group has too much political power and is being abused, that will lead to ethnic conflict. There are exceptions, and these exceptions are important. I mean, you know, the exception of Tanzania is important. The exception of Ghana, for the most part, is important, because here are groups in which ethnicity has not served as the principal reason for people's political victories or their political contestation in the country. There has been some very keen awareness of not falling into the trap of being locked into ethnic conflict in determining political power, overcoming the political definition of who it means to be an African in a particular space, in a particular nation, to overcome the colonial Eurocentric definition of themselves. And this was the effort of the African independence movement. And then finally, the world continues to practice hypocrisy in Africa. The war on terror in Africa is a bunch of hypocrisy. Who had more terror than the colonial powers? And most terror in the world does not come from non-state actors. Think about it. Most terror is a result of states engaging in mass murder that they call war. More people, more innocent people, more non-combatants on planet Earth are dying in wars being fought by legitimate states. And the death is being caused more by these wars and more by these legitimate states than any terrorist organization on planet Earth. I'm not trying to legitimate terror. I don't think terror is good. We need to abandon it. However, I think it's hypocrisy to say that you're going to engage on a war in terror and it destabilizes Mali. It destabilizes Libya. It destabilizes countries all over the African continent in the name of a fight against the war against terror. And then the use of aid, the way that aid is given to Africa, again, is hypocrisy. How are the nations which are benefiting totally from the raw resources of Africa going to claim that they're coming to give Africa aid?
Well, Professor,
they should call it a rebate. Okay.
I'm really totally interested and will continue to plow through this fabulous book, which is thoroughly accessible, African Independence, How Africa Shapes the World. You're, through the film, an award-winning director, the documentary, and most significantly now, we're going to have to continue this discussion at another time. The film, The Access, which looks at Benin and Cape Verde and Ghana and Kenya and Tanzania and Zambia, etc., is just a must reading. How can people access the film? And where do we get a copy of the book? And we have about a minute left, not nearly enough time to do justice to the issue, which is why people are just going to have to make sure that they get this critically important study of Africa in the modern world. And where do we do that?
So the book should be available widely. And if you want to get it, if you have the internet, you can type in tukufuzuberi.com. TukufuZuberi.com. And you can get both the book and the film in both of those places. TukufuZuberi.com. TukufuZuberi.com.
And Professor Tukufu Zuberi, who's been talking about African independence, how Africa shapes the world, a book. The film, tremendous information, and thank you for breaking through for many of us the centrality, the supremacy, it thinks, of Eurocentrism as a way of analyzing the world and placing Africa in the important perspective that it must be placed for us to grow intellectually and become a much more egalitarian group of people in society. I really appreciate your spending some time with us and wish you really good luck on the continuing access that people have through African Independence, How Africa Shapes the World, the book and the film. Professor Tukufu Zuberi, thanks for sharing time with us.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
I knew I wasn't a straight man. I knew that I didn't fit in with the gay men. I didn't know where I belonged until I met the first trans woman. Us older generation trans women had to either fly in stealth mode like I've been doing or live in extremely insular communities in order to survive.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A Zimbabwe labor court rules in favor of a gay man's employment rights. High-profile conferences discuss family values in Rome and Salt Lake City. And trucker Patty travels the transformation trail. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending October 31st, 2015. Good news for LGBT people out of Zimbabwe is rare, which is why a report from the Southern African nation leads our newscast this week. According to the Voice of America, and cited by other news outlets, a court in the city of Bulawayo ruled this week that a man was unlawfully fired from his job because he's gay. Labor Court President Justice Evangelista Cabasa upheld Raymond Sabanda's challenge to his dismissal from a civil service post, ruling that no one should be fired based on his or her sexual orientation. Sabanda worked as a youth officer for the Ministry of Youth and Economic Empowerment. He was sacked last year after a disciplinary hearing found him guilty of violating civil service regulations against putting the name of the ministry into disrespect and disrepute. That followed Sabanda's arrest and payment of an admission of guilt fine in late December 2013 on charges of performing an indecent act in a public place. He was netted in a police raid of a Christmas party in a Bulawayo hotel being hosted by the advocacy group Gays and Lesbians of Zimbabwe, or GALS. Justice Cabasa said the case against Sabanda had no merit because it involved a moral issue over which there is no absolute right or wrong. Mojalifa Mokoele of the Sexual Rights Center said the ruling was a milestone achievement for us as an organization that advocates for sexual rights, especially those of minority groups, and called it justice served.
Lawyers from the Attorney General's Civil Division said they agreed with the court that the case had no merit, but represented the youth ministry at the insistence of an unnamed department head who had wanted Sabanda fired to send a message that the government does not support gay activities. LGBT and other human rights activists insist that the Constitution of Zimbabwe actually guarantees equality to all and prohibits discrimination on any basis. Ngubane Nyathi of the Abameli Human Rights Lawyers Organization said that everyone has that right to equality regardless of whether they are gay or bisexual, lesbian or transgender, and to dismiss anyone based on such prejudices is in clear violation of that right to equality and non-discrimination. Nevertheless, longtime Zimbabwe strongman and world-renowned homophobe Robert Mugabe has railed against gays and lesbians for years, calling them worse than dogs and pigs. And sodomy laws remaining from the late 19th century, when the country was known as Rhodesia, still define unlawful and intentional sexual relations between two human males as a crime. Laws passed in 2006 criminalize any actions perceived to be gay, including two men holding hands, hugging, or kissing, and essentially make public demonstrations of LGBT pride illegal in Zimbabwe. Lesbian sex has never been against the law there. Marriage equality was constitutionally banned in 2013.
But Ireland equality advocates lauded the Presidential Commission's October 29th endorsement of a bill ratifying the May referendum opening civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. The Chief Justice and leaders of each chamber of parliament stood in for President Michael Higgins, who was out of the country and was unable to sign the bill into law in person. May's overwhelming 62% vote in favor of marriage equality and its becoming the official law of the land this week were each celebrated across the country, in some cases with literal dancing in the streets. The final step is a commencement order from Minister for Justice Francis Fitzgerald that will allow same-gender couples to start getting married. Weddings are expected to begin by mid-November. Senator Catherine Zappone, who's from the U.S. state of Washington and married her Irish wife in Canada, praised her adopted country for its progress. "A defining moment has been reached in our development as a nation," she said, "and together we are sending out a message to the world that Ireland is a country where people continue to believe in equality for all." Zappone famously proposed to her partner, Anne-Louise Gilligan, on live TV after the results of the marriage equality referendum were announced. They plan to renew their vows in Ireland in the new year. The Emerald Isle's equally progressive gender recognition bill, which sailed through Parliament in July, allows transgender people to declare their gender identity without a mental health practitioner's approval or medical intervention.
But more than 20 transgender women have been arrested in the predominantly Muslim Southeast Asian nation of Malaysia since the federal court's October 8th ruling upheld a law making cross-dressing a crime. The Negeri Sembilan state based its ban on Islamic law, or Sharia, and the law technically only applies to Muslims. But the transgender advocacy group Justice for Sisters said in a media statement this week that transgender women of all ethnicities and nationalities are being targeted, specifically referencing the arrests of Indian and Filipino transgender women in different parts of the country, including Kuala Lumpur. Some detainees have had their heads shaved bald. Justice for Sisters charges that harassment and intimidation began in Negeri Sembilan on the day that the federal court decision was announced, but noted that arrests are happening in other parts of the country too. "These actions are making people feel unsafe in their own homes and to move around freely," the group said. "Laws that criminalize one's gender identity and gender expression make transgender or trans women, regardless of religious background, vulnerable to arbitrary arrests and violence." The global advocacy group Human Rights Watch has also denounced the government crackdown.
In other news, and concluding 3 weeks of closed-door debate at the Vatican, Roman Catholic bishops have agreed to soften their stance towards divorced couples, but not to change the Church's strict doctrine on homosexuality, still condemning the sin but loving the sinner. The outcome of the Synod on the Family, that was presided over by Pope Francis, disappointed reformers who had hoped for more inclusive language towards same-gender attracted congregants. While the final document was expected to offer hope for the full reintegration into the Church of some divorced and remarried couples, Cardinal Christoph Schönborn of Vienna told a news conference that the Document of Consensus discusses sexual minorities only in the context of families that have a gay or lesbian member and how to manage this situation as Christians. According to insiders, African bishops were particularly adamant in their opposition to any welcoming language regarding gays and lesbians, saying it would only confuse the faithful. "This does not mean that it is not an important topic for the Church in Europe and North America," Schönborn said. "But on a universal level, you have to respect political and cultural situations."
Meanwhile, a Polish priest at the Vatican who was fired after coming out as a partnered gay man prior to the start of the synod was soon thereafter defrocked by his bishop. In a letter to Pope Francis written on the same day he came out but only made public this week, Krzysztof Taramsa charged that the Roman Catholic Church is frequently violently homophobic and makes LGBT Catholics' lives a hell, despite the widely held belief that closeted gay Catholic priests proliferate. They also disputed the equally prevalent belief that there is some kind of underground gay lobby in Rome. Taramsa thanked Pope Francis for some of his conciliatory comments about LGBT people, but said they'll be meaningful only if the Church reverses some of its attitudes. He denounced the current homophobic hate of the Church, the exclusion, the marginalization, and the stigmatization of people like me.
And finally, proving that the proverbial apple doesn't fall far from the tree, the father of right-wing Republican presidential hopeful Ted Cruz made headlines at this week's traditional values-oriented World Congress of Families in Salt Lake City, Utah, with his warning about what's next for the LGBT rights movement. Joining a chorus of speakers that included Brian Brown of the National Organization for Marriage and Kathy Ruse of the Family Research Council condemning the U.S. Supreme Court's June marriage equality ruling, Reverend Rafael Cruz also warned that faith communities are under attack, falsely claiming that the high court ruling made it possible for some homosexual to come to your church demanding to be hired, whether as a pastor or janitor, is immaterial. The World Congress of Families, which drew more than 3,000 participants from around the globe in its ninth year, was the first Congress to be held in the United States. The week-long gathering is organized by the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, which is based in Rockford, Illinois. It calls itself a Center for Research on the Natural Family and describes the Congress as the world's premier pro-family gathering. The Center and the Congress are jointly designated as an anti-LGBT hate group by the well-respected Southern Poverty Law Center. And despite sustained calls by LGBT rights activists to cancel his appearance at the gathering, Utah Governor Gary Herbert gave a brief welcoming address that, according to the local Deseret News, avoided mention of any specific hot-button political issue. But topping the more outrageous statements made at this week's Family Values Palooza, where several other participants also sounded the decades-old alarm about child molestation, the elder Cruz told a BuzzFeed reporter covering the conference that the LGBT movement's next goal is the legalization of pedophilia.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 31st, 2015. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
Attention all LGBT U.S. history buffs, collectors, and listener supporters. You can now own a very special edition of This Way Out.
Today, being gay is not a crime.
This is going to lead to the legalization of same-sex marriage.
Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA.
This is social engineering by a court.
Is this Jim?
Yes, it is, Mr. President.
I just want to say congratulations.
Today, some of the darkest 24 hours in our nation's history.
It's the day I finally get to look at the man that I love and finally say, will you please marry me?
From outlaws to in-laws traces the legal evolution of the U.S. Supreme Court from the decriminalization of private consensual adult gay sex in 2003 to making marriage equality the law of the land in 2015.
This special edition features the voices of dozens of equality advocates over those years who made the journey possible, despite always outspoken opposition along the way. From outlaws to in-laws also includes a wide variety of thematic music.
You'll find all the info you need about this very special edition of This Way Out at thiswayout.org.
Well, isn't that special?
There's nothing so international as a powerful idea. I'm Edmund White. It is the overwhelming international flavor of the lesbian and gay rights movement that has proved so powerful over the past couple of decades. And one radio program has been there to record, to inform, and to entertain. So please keep listening to This Way Out on this station.
Yeah, Breaker 19, this here's a rubber duck. You got a copy on me, Big Ben, come on. Yeah, 10-4, Big Ben, for sure, for sure. By golly, it's clean, clear to Flagtown, come on. Yeah, it's a big 10-4 there, Big Ben. Yeah, we definitely got the front door, good buddy. Mercy sakes alive, looks like we've got us a convoy.
There are coming-of-age stories and
coming out of the closet stories and coming to terms with gender identity stories. Some stand out because they have an every queer quality that says something profound about universal experiences. Some are profound because they're so unique. This Way Out's Steve Pride found one of the unique ones.
Patty Spangler is over 60, a cancer survivor, a Navy vet, a transgendered woman who was born intersex and lived as a man for nearly 30 years. She was also a big rig driver, known on the interstates as Trucker Patty, and is quite simply one of the most interesting people I know.
Hello, everybody. My name is Patty Spangler. I am known by friends and other people as Trucker Patty. When I was 3 years old, I asked my mother why I did not have the same equipment that my best friend Susie had. Why was I different? Because I was supposed to be a girl. I knew from my very earliest memories that there was something different about me. And I learned very quickly that was not acceptable. I was teased the whole time I was growing up because I was very effeminate. I was a sissy. When I got into high school, I always made sure I had a girlfriend because that way then they couldn't tease me because, you know, it was very hard for me to try to act like a male. And I like to tell people that I was born with a terrible growth in my vagina. Just like every other woman on the planet, I have two X chromosomes. But unlike a lot of other women on the planet, I also have a Y chromosome. And that gave me a penis that has never, ever belonged there. It took me many years to understand what my problem was. And I was fortunate enough that I was able to fix it by a fairly young age. I had my sex reassignment surgery when I was 28.
Tell me about that.
I had been to Stanford University Medical Center's Gender Dysphoria Clinic, and I believe it was 1980. And they had referred me to an endocrinologist for my hormones. And she had had some knowledge of Klinefelter's syndrome, which is what the XXY is called. And I had never heard of it before. I just always knew I was supposed to be a girl. Klinefelter's, some of the characteristics of it are very little facial or body hair, usually fairly tall, no Adam's apple, very feminine in appearance, and frequently natural breasts. And that was me to a T. So after examining me to prescribe hormones for me, she asked if I would mind if she did a chromosome structure. Well, I didn't know what the heck a chromosome structure was. And I said, well, yeah, if you think I need it, go for it. That was when I found out what Klinefelter's was and that it was something that I did indeed have. And it was the key factor in why my medical insurance company paid for my surgery.
What about your childhood?
I hated the fact that I was different. I mean, I tried everything that you could think of to butch it up, to be acceptable, playing sports. Sports was big with my father because he'd been a professional baseball player. I tried everything. I always knew I was different. I really understood the attraction to men more when I was 14 and a couple of my older brother's friends started basically sexually abusing me. I didn't realize it was abuse at the time. You know, I thought because I was attracted to boys, I didn't realize that, you know, it could be very damaging for a 14-year-old to be messing around with 16-year-old boys, especially when they were doing things to me that I didn't want them to do. There was never any question in my own mind that I was a woman, but I didn't want to be different. I kept thinking, well, as long as I have a girlfriend, I'm fine. Nobody can call me a queer. And I wound up marrying my girlfriend because I figured that's what I need to do. If I get married, all this other stuff is going to go away and I am going to be a normal person. And that's all I wanted. And that was the catalyst between getting married. And then I was in the Navy at the time. I was a musician in the Navy. And I was transferred to New Orleans, Louisiana, to be a part of the Navy Steel drum band. While I was there and fascinated with the French Quarter, I went into my first gay bar. I knew then that I couldn't live the way I was living anymore. I told my wife that I was gay and that we had to split up. And I started exploring the gay scene in New Orleans. I met a bartender at the Bourbon Pub, which is still there on Bourbon Street, still very busy gay bar today. And he put me in drag for Halloween. And there were so many people that thought he had brought a fag hag friend with him on the round of the bars because I appeared like a biological woman, that I was encouraged by him and a couple of other drag queen friends of his to start doing drag. I had always been interested in theater and performing, and so that was sort of a natural fit for me. But it was while doing drag that I met the first trans women, and this would have been probably 1977. Finally, there was somebody who was like me, because I knew I wasn't a straight man. I knew that I didn't fit in with the gay men. I didn't know where I belonged until I met the first trans woman. From there, it was just, how do I go about doing this? I worked at a transgender bar called the Midship in the French Quarter from 1978 to 1980, trying to do this. And then finally, in July of 1982 at St. Luke's Hospital in San Francisco, my body finally matched the rest of me.
How'd you become a trucker?
I had read an article about husband and wife truck drivers. My husband was a submarine sailor in the Navy, and he had originally was going to make a career out of it. But he started having second thoughts about that, and I told him about this article that I read, and we thought it would be fun to do together. Then he didn't want to be married anymore. And then he told me that I couldn't go do it by myself. That was the wrong thing to tell me, because if you tell me I can't do something, I want to prove you wrong. But I think a lot of it for me was I was tired about worrying about people that I met that might possibly figure out what I was. And this seemed like a good way to not be around so many people. And I'd always loved to drive and I'd always loved to travel. So in a way, it was kind of an escape for me. During my transition period, I had a bit of trauma that I never addressed. I was beaten and raped by a guy that turned out to be a serial killer in New Orleans in 79 or 80. There was a girl named Angel that he killed, and a second girl whose name was Bobby Mattia, who barely escaped with her life. She had to jump out a second floor window and broke her leg to get away from the guy. His name was Rusty. You know, in those days, you met somebody cute in the bar and you took him home and had fun. And he knocked me out with the champagne bottle and then he raped me with it. When I woke up in the hospital, they had not yet figured out that I was transgendered. And they were really, really nice to me. Then, for some reason, my panty girdle was removed and my little secret popped out there. It was like turning on a lamp. They went from compassionate and caring to, oh, she got what she deserved.
Patty, for most of your life, you've been what they call stealth, not out as transgendered. Why?
The reason for that is when it comes to sex, I'm more of a traditional person. The idea of me being with a man that was turned on by the fact that I was trans was not something that was ever attractive to me. I wanted a regular guy. And I'm telling you right now, a regular guy back 20, 30 years ago was going to want anything to do with a woman that had been born with a penis. So that's why the deep stealth mode happens. And it's very dangerous. It's why you hear of trans women being murdered or beat up because they try to fly under the radar. And many do for years. I mean, I think how fortunate I was all those years that nobody ever discovered. But living with a secret like that takes a toll on a person. You know, I don't recommend it for anybody. That's why I'm working so hard now to bring trans awareness and understanding. Because until that happens, people like me can't have the simplest thing in the world, just a normal life, to be a person that feels like they deserve love. I've never, ever felt like someone who deserved love because I was different. I had a secret and I had to do everything for every man that I ever was with because I was lucky enough to have a man that wanted me. I realize now how horrible it was to be that way. For me, it was just the way that it was. Us older generation trans women, we had to either fly in stealth mode like I've been doing or live in extremely insular communities in order to survive. And now that it is becoming better for all LGBTQ people, trans people like gays and lesbians are coming out much earlier. They still have a harder row to hoe. The highest rate of suicide amongst youth is transgendered youth. The highest percentage rate of homelessness amongst youth are transgendered youth. The highest rate of sex workers amongst youth are transgendered youth. But still, they're starting to get a little bit more of a voice.
You've overcome so many obstacles. I think you're very brave.
I don't feel brave. I actually feel embarrassed a lot of the time because it took me 25 years to finally make a stand and say, hey, this is not right. So that's what I'm trying to do in the nicest, most positive, most progressive way possible is to say, hey, guys, we're here and we're queer and we need your help.
This has been a conversation with Patty Spangler, a.k.a. Trucker Patty. You can follow her adventures on Facebook or on her blog at Trucker Patty, that's Patty with an I, .blogspot.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Perry, Michael LeBeau, John Dyer V, and Steve Pride contributed program material. C.W. McCall performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, our social media links, and more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com. Or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org, on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher, and on WRIR Richmond, Virginia, 2SER Sydney, New South Wales, KGNU Boulder, Fort Collins, Ward, and Denver, Colorado, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Today on Against the Grain, a revolutionary socialist, fervent opponent of colonialism, staunch anti-sectarian and maverick champion of gay liberation, the French writer and activist Daniel Guérin's life spanned the gamut of many of the key radical movements of the 20th century with an unusual twist. He was in turn a Marxist, then an anarchist, then synthesized the two traditions. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with scholar Dave Barry about Guérin's life and legacy. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Marxists and anarchists have frequently been at odds, at least since the split between Marx and Bakunin in the First International, through the Bolshevik repression of anarchist sailors in Kronstadt, to the communist attacks on anarchists during the Spanish Revolution and beyond. But do the two traditions have more in common than such a history would indicate? An affirmative to that question informed the work of the French writer and activist Daniel Guérin, who was a Marxist in his early years, later becoming an anarchist, and then finally creating a synthesis of the two. The avowedly anti-sectarian Guérin, who was born in 1904 and died in 1988, wrote many works of history and analysis, including Class Struggle in the First Republic and Anarchism from Theory to Practice. He was also a pioneer of French gay liberation. Anarchist scholar Dave Barry has written extensively about Guérin. He's co-editor of the volume Libertarian Socialism, Politics in Black and Red, and he teaches in the Department of Politics, History, and International Relations at Loughborough University in the UK, where he joins me now. Dave Barry, I wonder if you could give us a sense of Guérin's origins.
Well, Guérin, perhaps surprisingly, actually came from a very, very wealthy background. I don't know how many people in your audience will have heard of Hachette, which is one of the biggest publishing houses in France. You go in any railway station, any airport in France, and there will be an Hachette shop. And Guérin was actually the heir to the Hachette empire. So he came from this very, very wealthy family from the grande bourgeoisie, the haute bourgeoisie in Paris, which sort of made its money in the sort of last decades of the 19th century and the start of the 20th. And so he actually came from a very, very privileged family. And some branches of his family were clearly quite reactionary, but actually the branch of his branch of the family, certainly his parents and some of his closer relatives, were also very liberal, very cultured, for their class in some respects, quite progressive. His parents had been very much, at the time of the Dreyfus Affair in the 1890s, his branch of the family had been very much pro-Dreyfus.
It was a campaign against a French officer who was Jewish, an anti-Semitic campaign.
That's right, yeah. Captain Dreyfus was basically framed and accused of having spied for the Germans, and basically it blew up into this massive conflict between pro-Dreyfus and anti-Dreyfus campaigners, and it had a lot to do with militarism, with anti-Semitism, ideas about the role of the Catholic Church in France, which, of course, was very, very central right through the 19th century. And to an extent about the conflict, the sort of century-long conflict between monarchists and republicans. And so his family were, in fact, relatively progressive, despite the fact that they belonged to this the sort of upper echelons of the bourgeoisie. His father had also been influenced in his youth by sort of left-wing ideas. He was very interested in social issues. He worked for the Social Museum in Paris. His mother had translated as well. His mother had translated some of Tolstoy's writings. And his father also had very strong pacifist tendencies. And one of the earliest, I suppose, political influences, if you like, on Guérin in his youth were his experience of the First World War, at which point he was very young. He was born in 1904, so at the time of the First World War, he was, what, sort of 6 to 10. Some of the earliest things he remembers that were sort of politically had a sort of significant effect on him, politically speaking, were his father's revulsion at the slaughter and the war, his refusal to support the sort of saber-rattling jingoism that was prevalent at the time, of course. That was his background, and those things only really changed in the 1920s. He led a very, very sheltered life. He had a very privileged education. He went to one of the most prestigious lycée high schools in Paris. He went to the Institute of Political Studies in Paris, which was also sort of one of the most prestigious tertiary education institutions in the country. And it only really changed in the early 1920s after he'd completed his studies and completed his military service. And, of course, when he did his military service, he wasn't a student. He was automatically sent to officer school because of his class. But after all that, he was sent to work by his family for the family firm, Hachette. And the first job he had was in a very working-class part of north-central Paris. And the way he tells it in his autobiographical writings and in one or two sort of filmed interviews that exist of Guérin, the way he tells it is it's like travelling to another land. It was a parallel universe that he had never. There are whole swathes of Paris which Guérin had never seen, never discovered, and these were the working class parts of town. And it was through contacts, the sort of discovery of the working class parts of Paris, and through contacts he made, largely through a whole string of sexual relationships he had with young Parisian workers, that he came to discover the realities of ordinary everyday life for working class French people.
And so that what might be called workerist orientation is something that stayed with him through his life as he became more radicalized. I wonder if you could describe the politics of the time when he really came of age, which was in the late 1920s, 1930s. What was the spectrum of politics on the left in France, in Paris, as he was attracted more and more to radical politics?
The left in France at that time was dominated really by the Socialist Party. The Communist Party had been created at the end of 1920. But the left as a whole went through something of a crisis over the next decade or so. The labour movement, which Guérin became involved with around about 1930, was also very, very divided. By 1926, the CGT had been split. There were two big trade union confederations. The CGT was much closer to the Socialist Party. The CGTU was completely dominated by the Communist Party. And, of course, this was the sort of class against class period. So it was a very dogmatic, very militant phase, very workerist phase that the Communist Party was going through. There was also a very, very small anarcho-syndicalist organisation, the CGTSR, the Revolutionary Syndicalist, CGT, but that had very, very little influence because it was so small. And that's the sort of situation that Girard found when he first became involved in trade union politics and in left-wing politics around about 1930. And in fact, the first campaign he became involved with was in 1930 when he joined Pierre Monnat, who was by that stage the old pre-1914 revolutionary syndicalism incarnate. And he had gone to revolutionary syndicalism from anarchism. So Monnat represented a very sort of what was by that stage already a rather sort of old-fashioned, stereotypical, very strongly anarchistic revolutionary syndicalism. And the campaign which Girard became involved with, and I think this is typical and tells us something about Girard's approach generally and one that would stick with him for the rest of his political life, really, was a campaign to reunite the two big trade union confederations to try and overcome this split between these two elements in the left, and you know this thrust towards trying to get different factions, different currents, different tendencies on the left to work together is something he'd sort of devote a lot of energy to over the rest of his life, really.
How did he regard the French Communist Party on the one hand, which was a member of the Stalinized Communist International in the 1930s, and then the Social Democratic Socialist Party on the other?
He was really quite torn in the sort of early mid-1930s. He was very attracted to... he saw socialism as being about the oppression of the working classes. So he had this very sort of workerist attitude or approach, as you commented before. So to some extent, he was very attracted to the Communist Party because it was by far the most working class party. The Socialist Party was obviously had a lot of working class members, but it also contained a lot of petty bourgeois and bourgeois elements as well, and that was something which Girard was very aware of and very critical because it had inevitably had an impact on the party's approach to politics, on its strategy, on its objectives. And he was very critical of the Socialist Party for being so dogmatically anti-communist, in the same way he was also critical of the Communist Party for being so dogmatic, and also for being so slavish in its following the Moscow line, basically. And he actually ended up joining the Socialist Party because he thought that, well, at least in the Socialist Party, you weren't obliged. You did at least have the freedom to debate different opinions, different interpretations and so on inside the Socialist Party. So there was a much greater degree of sort of freedom of debate in the Socialist Party. So even though he had a lot of criticisms of the sort of petty bourgeois reformism of the leadership, as he saw it, it was the lesser of two evils in a way. Having said that, when he joined the party, he immediately gravitated towards its most left-wing faction, which was a faction called the Revolutionary Left, which was led by a character called Marcel Pivert, to whom he would become very close throughout the Popular Front period.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with David Berry about Daniel Guérin, the French writer and activist who fused Marxism and anarchism. Dave Barry teaches in the Department of Politics, History and International Relations at Loughborough University in the UK, where he joins us from. So you mentioned the dominant parties in France at the time in the 1930s, the French Communist Party and the Socialist Party. And then, of course, there were much smaller groupings that didn't necessarily have the adherence of large numbers of workers. And one of those smaller groupings was the small Trotskyist movement in France. What was the influence of that group and the ideas of Leon Trotsky, who was in exile in the 1930s, on Guérin?
Yeah, I was going to say the political influence of French Trotskyism was virtually nil. But as far as Guérin was concerned, yeah, I mean, Guérin was very close to Trotsky. Within the syndicalist movement, he'd been very close to those who adopted a sort of Trotskyist interpretation, whether it was the nature of fascism, the strategy of the Popular Front, of course, which was a sort of broad coalition of the Socialist Party, the Communist Party, and the so-called, well, bit of a misnomer really, but the Radical Party, which was actually itself something of a broad church of the sort of centre-left to centre-right. Yes, so Guérin was actually very strongly influenced by Trotskyism and by Trotsky. He met Trotsky, in fact, in 1933, during his exile, he actually spent a couple of years in France between, if I remember correctly, 1933 and 35. And there was a period when he was in under house arrest in a small place called Barbizon near Fontainebleau, not far from Paris, and Guérin visited him there. And he was a great admirer. He also, it must be said, had a lot of reservations about what he saw as Trotsky's, well, he thought Trotsky had sectarian and dogmatic tendencies, and he was particularly critical of his, what Guérin saw as a tendency in Trotsky to constantly draw parallels with what happened in Russia at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, and to draw conclusions on that basis. He didn't think that was adequately Marxist, I suppose. Guérin argued that you had to look much more at the specific, particular circumstances and conditions, economic, social, political, in France, and that simply to constantly transpose a kind of model, which Guérin felt Trotsky did, was misleading and wrong. He also disagreed with the creation of the Fourth International in 1938, because he thought the movement was simply too small and weak for it to have any real impact, was simply divisive.
And this was Trotsky's declaration of a new international, a new communist international to follow the Third International, which was seen to be dominated by Stalin and therefore not something that could be rehabilitated. Is that correct?
That's right. Whereas Guérin's approach was much more, I suppose, to try and work towards a broad alliance of all the revolutionary forces. Not, it must be said, with the kind of bourgeois liberals who were involved in the Popular Front. Guérin was very critical of the Popular Front because he saw it as, well, it was really an alliance of reformist socialism, Stalinist communism, which at the time was often referred to by anarchists and other people on the extreme left as national communism, because in 1935 it renamed itself. It had previously just been the Communist Party, renamed itself the French Communist Party, and it adopted the whole sort of patriotic, even nationalistic kind of discourse that it felt was necessary in order to gain broader popular support in France, and also because that was the strategy adopted by the Moscow International. And Guérin drew a very clear distinction between two different meanings of the Popular Front, which was a sort of massive wave of social unrest that began in the spring, summer of 1936, involved massive strikes, occupations by workers, and so on, and which led to the election of a Popular Front government, which brought in a certain number of sort of social reforms. People still argue now about their sort of longer-term value, but Guérin drew a clear distinction between what he saw as this kind of electoral alliance, which was doomed to failure, and the Popular Front as a grassroots, extra-parliamentary working-class movement.
What was Daniel Guérin's, what did he conclude out of his connection with Trotskyism and with all of these other movements in the 1930s about the value or lack thereof of the Leninist party model, which the Trotskyists embraced, as did the French Communist Party?
Yeah, well, this, of course, was another major reason why Guérin would eventually split from Trotsky and Trotskyism. He was actually he was a paid-up member of the Fourth International during the Second World War, and it was with the Trotskyists that he chose to work in their resistance activities when he was back in Paris. And the distinctive thing there was that the sort of communist resistance adopted, as I've already said, a very sort of nationalistic kind of discourse, and talked about Germans rather than Nazis, whereas the Trotskyists based all of their resistance on a class analysis. And so they didn't only organise attacks on German military targets and so on. They also organised illegal strikes, attempts at unionisation, and so on and so forth. But Guérin actually split from Trotskyism definitively, despite he kept some very close friends right through until his death, actually. And he had very friendly relations with a lot of the leading Trotskyists in Europe throughout the post-war years. But he split from the movement after a couple of years he spent in the United States, in fact. Just after the Second World War, he got financial support, actually, from the government to go and do some extended research, and it was sold as a sociological study of contemporary United States society. And while he was in the States, he spent over 2 years traveling around the United States. I was just checking my notes earlier, actually. He was in Oakland at one point, gave a talk to something called the General Labor Council, I think. Part of the time he was doing his research, visited all sorts of workplaces, black American organizations, trade unions, all sorts of things. But he also went round a lot of local branches of the Workers' Party in the Socialist Workers' Party, which had just split. And he was, of course, a personal friend of C.L.R. James. But it was, he said afterwards in his autobiography, that it was his experience of the U.S. Trotskyist movement, despite, and he was always very careful to qualify these kinds of damning statements, despite their undoubted commitment and sincerity and hard work of the activists concerned. It was his experience of the Trotskyist, the two different Trotskyist parties in the States, that really alienated him sort of definitively from any form of Trotskyist or Leninist party organization, because of its very sort of centralizing, to his mind, very dogmatic and very sectarian approach.
Dave Barry is my guest. We'll return with him in just a moment.
Thank you.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about the French libertarian communist Daniel Guérin, author of many works, including Anarchism from Theory to Practice and the collection No Gods, No Masters. I'm speaking with scholar Dave Berry, who's written extensively about Guérin. He is co-editor of the collection Libertarian Socialism, Politics in Black and Red, which is published by Palgrave and includes an essay by Berry on Daniel Guérin. So, David, you were mentioning Guérin's trajectory away from Trotskyism, away from Leninism, in fact, towards a kind of a, if you will, non-orthodox Marxism. And you write that he was, in this period, was attempting to run against the grain of much of Marxism at the time, to try and separate Marxism from Bolshevism. What did that look like in practice? How was it reflected in his thinking? And to what degree was it reflected in the kinds of political associations he made at the time?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to overstate the significance of this because in the post-war decades, certainly through until the 60s, the French Communist Party was completely dominant on the left in France, both intellectually, in the trade unions, politically. It was the, although it was excluded from government from 1947 until the first socialist government of the Fifth Republic in the 1980s, it was the biggest single political party in France, both in terms of the number of votes and in terms of members. Intellectually, the whole of the sort of intellectual life in France was, to a very large extent, dominated by members of the Communist Party or fellow travellers. Having said that, Guérin wasn't alone in this. There were circles, there were networks of people, and I'm currently working on this now, some of whom were critical Trotskyists or ex-Trotskyists. Some of them were former members of the Communist Party, who were involved with a number of journals and reviews which appeared in the late 1940s and 50s and through into the 60s, linked, for instance, with people like Cornelius Castoriadis and his group, Socialism and Barbarism. And there was a lot of these journals were focused on trying to rethink Marxism or move beyond Marxism in some way. And the interesting thing is that the anarchist movement, although far, far less influential at the time, was going through a similar kind of period of questioning, if you like, of what had become anarchist orthodoxies, or what was often referred to as traditional anarchism. And that manifested itself notably in the creation of an organization called the Libertarian Communist Federation, which grew out of the existing Anarchist Federation, and there were splits within the movement and so on and so forth. And Guérin was quite close to them. And you asked how it manifested itself in practice. Well, one of the most important ways it manifested itself was in, had to do with the process of decolonization, which became one of the most important political issues in the period. You have to remember France was, or had been, the second biggest colonial empire in the world and was going through a similar process of decolonization to that which the UK, Britain, was also going through at the time. And the Algerian War of Independence between 1954 and 62 was incredibly important in this respect. And this is because the Socialist Party had supported the war of repression in an attempt to keep Algeria as part of France. The Communist Party had been very equivocal in the position it adopted towards the Algerian War of Independence. And the only two currents on the left which were consistently in support of the struggle for independence was the Libertarian Communist Federation and the some of the different Trotskyist organisations. And it's at that point that these two currents establish much closer links and certain sort of connections appear. The Libertarian Communist Federation distinguished itself from what you might call a more traditional anarchism already, in the sense that it was much more open to certain aspects of Marxism. It accepted historical materialism, for example, and was much keener to focus on the organisation of an anarchist movement, an anarchist organisation, which would be effective without necessarily being as centralised as some of the Marxist organisations, although that's not how it was seen by the more individualist anarchists. And that's the point at which Guillaume starts really to become seriously interested in anarchism. And so, you know, you see the beginnings of his move away from Marxism towards becoming more directly involved with the anarchist movement.
How did the 1956 Hungarian Revolution influence that shift? Obviously, for lots of people who identified as Marxists or communists, the 50s were a time of great upheaval. The death of Stalin was followed by Khrushchev's denunciations, and then the Soviet repression of the Hungarian Revolution, which many people on the radical left, including C.L.R. James, who you mentioned, the great Trinidadian Marxist, looked toward as a model of workers setting up councils and a kind of indication of the capacity of workers to organize themselves in a radical way.
Exactly. I mean, it had an enormous effect on Guérin, reinforced him in opinions he already had. Of course, it did cause 1956 caused an enormous crisis for all the West European communist parties. It also coincided, as far as Guérin was concerned, with his discovery, apparently, of the complete works of Bakunin, which he devoured with great enthusiasm. And he writes in one of his autobiographical texts somewhere that the discovery of Bakunin was like a sort of cataract operation, and that it made him forever allergic to any kind of authoritarian organisation, whether it be Marxist, Leninist, Trotskyist, Stalinist, whatever. And so that was quite a turning point for Guérin. And he also made him... He had already had contacts with a number of non-orthodox Marxists, including people like Marcuse and so on, and also Karl Korsch and so on. And 56 rekindled an interest in Guérin in the whole Councilist tradition, which he began to study as well. And his work on his sort of rather revisionist study of class conflict within the revolutionary camp in the French Revolution, which was first published in 1945, and a slightly modified edition version came out in 1968. That had focused very much on very limited conceptions of the role of local direct forms of direct democracy. The sections, for example, Murray Bookchin and other people have also written about these. If you combine that with his interest in pre-war CGT revolutionary syndicalism, with its emphasis on locally based working class community organizations working in parallel with industrial trade union based organizations. This led Guérin to sort of develop a conception of libertarian socialism, which had an enormous, put an enormous emphasis on the role of councils, factory committees, Soviets, as they originally were before they were sort of hijacked by the Bolsheviks, as Guérin insisted had happened. So 1956 reinforced that move towards a kind of an openness to council communism and a sort of or libertarian communism, as he soon began to call it.
Would this then be considered his anarchist phase? And I'm not sure what you think of separating his thinking out into such periods. And if that's the case, how do you see a sort of synthesis of all the threads of his life politically and theoretically? How were those then tied together?
I know I comment in my chapter in the Libertarian Socialism book that it's the idea of phases is a bit problematic, because I think I'd argue that actually if you go back and look at his youthful writings and you follow through the political positions he adopted all the way through his life, that there is actually an enormous consistency. But certainly the way he described it looking back on those years was that the period from about 56 through to the mid-60s were what he described as his classical anarchist phase. And as well as discovering Bakunin and the council communist tradition, he also started to do a lot of work on Pierre-Joseph Proudhon. Proudhon, who was often referred to as the father of anarchy, Guérin, in fact, referred to him as the father of self-management, père de l'autogestion. And what he found particularly interesting in Proudhon, who up until that point had actually been denigrated, I think is probably not too strong a word, by the majority of anarcho-communists in the French mainstream of anarchism. What he thought was most interesting in Proudhon and most original, the most original contribution, if you like, was the work he produced on worker self-management, on workers' cooperatives and so on. And he came to see that as absolutely essential to any form of libertarian socialism or libertarian communism, which would enable the working class movement in any future revolution to ensure that the revolution was not hijacked, as he put it, by any kind of centralizing authoritarian or authoritarian tendencies. Because worker self-management, Guérin saw, as did Proudhon, as being the nucleus, if you like, of new society. The nucleus was at the base. This was absolutely essential. Power in society would be distributed at the base. It would be in local community councils of one kind or another, whatever you call them, Soviets or whatever, and they would be in self-managed workplaces.
That's the voice of Dave Berry. He is an editor of the journal Anarchist Studies and author of A History of the French Anarchist Movement, 1917 to 1945. We're talking to him about the ideas of Daniel Guérin, the French writer and activist who synthesized Marxism and anarchism, of whom he writes about, Berry writes about in a collection, Libertarian Socialism, Politics in Black and Red. And you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. So one thing that we haven't really touched on is Guérin's view of sexual freedom. When people tend to think of the history of the left over the 20th century, it tends to be very compartmentalized. The idea is you have workers on one side, on the other side, particularly with the new left, a turn toward issues of identity, sexuality, gender, and so on. And yet for Guérin, those questions were important to him personally and also politically.
Compartmentalized is a good word, actually, to use, because Guérin finally came out in about 1964, I think, from memory, early 60s, certainly. And Guérin had suffered enormously from being a gay, or sometimes he describes himself as bisexual, but I think it's a predominantly gay man in a very male, very masculine world. The labour movement, I'm sure this is the case in most, if not all, labour movements and the lefts in those days was, I don't know what I'm saying in those days, actually, very male-dominated, and to a large extent it was also homophobic. And throughout the 30s, 40s, 50s, he basically kept his sexuality a secret from the people he mixed with in his political, in inverted commas, life. In the period that he referred to as his classical anarchist phase, late 50s, sort of mid-50s, mid-60s, he didn't only rehabilitate Proudhon and anarchism more generally, he also shocked his new anarchist friends, as it were, by rehabilitating Max Stirner, who was complete anathema to all but a very tiny minority of individualists in France at the time.
And can you just tell us who Stirner was?
Sorry, Max Stirner was a German thinker who wrote The Ego and His Own, and was famously criticized in no uncertain terms by Marx in the German ideology, and is regarded as one of the major thinkers of individualist anarchism. He's become, I don't know whether I should use this word, but to my mind, rather fashionable in recent years amongst theorists in Britain and the States. But certainly at the time, he was anathema to the vast majority of anarchists and certainly Marxists and other socialists. But Guérin nevertheless attempted to sort of rehabilitate him to some extent. And I think it was because fairly clearly he saw Stirner as being the voice of nonconformism. He saw Stirner as rejecting any attempt by society to impose its norms on individuals. And Guérin was convinced, and he provides evidence for this in his, he analyzes the ways in which Stirner was translated from German to French. And but anyway, he had this theory that Stirner was gay. And he was convinced that this had to do with sexuality. And he actually wrote at one point, Stirner's greatest claim to originality, his most memorable contribution, if you like, was his discovery of the unique individual. Stirner became the voice of all those who throw down a challenge to normality. And he saw Stirner as a precursor of 1968 in that sense, as sort of the voice of nonconformism, the sort of challenge to social conformity. Basically, Guérin lived three decades bowing down to society's moral prejudices. He lived virtually a schizophrenic existence, and he came out in 1964, I think. He'd already written about the Kinsey Report, for example, very favourable study of Kinsey. He was interested in Reich and his efforts to synthesize psychoanalysis and Marxism. And he wrote increasingly about sexuality and the need for a revolution which wouldn't only be economic or political, but would also be social, be cultural, would affect everything in our everyday lives about the ways in which we behave with each other, about the sort of total, he talked about the need for the total liberation of the individual. Even nowadays, I was astonished once I went to a conference, I gave a talk about Gihon and sexuality, and I came out of the lecture hall and I was approached by somebody who said, "That was fascinating. I knew Guérin was a revolutionary and so, but I had no idea he was gay." This person left. About a minute later, somebody else came up to me and said, "Do you know, that was fascinating. I knew Guérin was a gay lib activist, but I had no idea he was a revolutionary anarchist as well." And so he's plagued with this sort of schizoid identity, even now amongst people in, I suppose, in a way, two separate movements, who still don't make the links when they're reading Guérin.
Well, that, of course, sounds very contemporary, what you're talking about his analysis of sexuality. In terms of his eventual fusion of anarchism and Marxism, what do you think we can draw from it today? Why do you think that Guérin as a thinker matters?
I think because he was fearless in criticizing or in questioning people's assumptions, people's easy assumptions, the willingness even of so-called revolutionaries to fall back on sort of ready-made answers, on sort of stock mantras and doctrines. And that applies to anarchists as well as to other activists. He had a lot of criticisms of both of anarchism as well as of Marxism. And his willingness to engage in debate, respectful debate, with anybody, basically, who he perceived as being, in broad terms, I suppose you could say, on the same side of the barricade. And the efforts he made, I think, to bring together people who, to his mind, were separated only by relatively minor theoretical differences and who shared much more than what separated them.
Well, that strong anti-sectarian tendency within Guérin's writing and his practice, his attitude towards other activists throughout his life, really runs counter to so much of the history of anarchism and Marxism, where the divisions have at times even been violent, often with anarchists on the receiving end in the Soviet Union during the Spanish Revolution. And I wonder if in looking at Guérin and also in thinking about the places where Marxism and anarchism overlap that you and your co-authors and co-editors have considered in the book, Libertarian Socialism, is there in fact more overlap than we tend to think when we look at the history of the left in the 20th century through that narrowly sectarian lens?
I think so. I think if you read the authors who contributed to that collection, Libertarian Socialism, Politics in Black and Red, and even actually I think probably if you compare the opinions of the four editors, we don't all necessarily agree. And I think it would also, I mean, clearly, you know, you mentioned the treatment of anarchists in Spain in 37 and later, or in Russia from 1919 onwards, or even earlier, you know, there have been, you know, very real episodes where the differences in strategy, the differences in analysis of situations have led to very, very real disagreements which have had often tragic consequences. So there's no point trying to sweep some real disagreements, real differences under the carpet, as it were. But I think it's certainly true that there are more overlaps. I think there's much greater convergence between different kinds of socialist than is often assumed. Add actually in passing, really, having said that, different kinds of socialism, Guérin was adamant that anarchism for him was a kind of socialism. And I think the kind of thinking which talks about anarchism in the singular and Marxism in the singular is fundamentally flawed, really. There has never been only one kind of anarchism. There has never been only one kind of Marxism. There have always been anarchisms. There have always been Marxisms. There have always been organizations, movements, tendencies, groups who have explicitly or implicitly been inspired by both Marxism and anarchism. But there has been for some time now a tendency to create essentialist, if you like, political identities with very clear boundaries between them. And I think that's a big mistake. Theoretically, I think it's mistaken. And I think in practical terms, for any socialist, it's a tactical or a strategic mistake as well, because it weakens the movement.
Well, important words for us to end on. Dave Berry, thank you so much.
I'm honored.
I've been speaking with David Berry. He is the author of a number of books, including A History of the French Anarchist Movement, 1917 to 1945. He's an editor of the journal Anarchist Studies and co-editor of the collection Libertarian Socialism, Politics in Black and Red, published by Palgrave. And that includes an essay by him on the French libertarian communist Daniel Guérin, who we have been discussing in this hour. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.